It's just past 6 o'clock, and I think it is time to start. First of all, I would just like to say that with it being Halloween, I have actually been booked in for an engagement in Newtown Hamilton, so I just wanted to be here for this first meeting, and then I'm going to hand over to Willie. I think what is happening here today is the result of a lot of hard work, and we have had the two working groups in, and their questions and queries have formed the bones of this meeting. We also here have tonight have representatives from the Public Health Agency as well as the Ambulance Service and the two trusts. So really this is a multi-agency approach for all of our health services. So hopefully it is the start of meetings which will be positive and constructive and will be led very much by our communities who we are all here to represent. Before I head off, if we maybe just start to my right and we do a quick introduction. We do have a lady hiding in here in the background. We're going to definitely have to pull our chair forward. But perhaps I could just ask everybody to introduce themselves to you. And then the first item on the agenda will be taken by Johnny, who is going to do a quick presentation on our community planning. And I will be vacating the chair and letting Willie take over. So could we just start with our introductions? Thank you.
I'm Shane Devlin, Chief Executive of the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service.
I'm Geraldine Moore, Assistant Director of Specialist Child Health and Disability, Southern Trust.
I'm Francis Rice, Chief Executive, Southern Trust.
Seamus McGoran, Director of Hospital Services at the South Eastern Trust, deputising for Hugh McCaughey, Chief Executive.
Aldrina Magwood, Director of Performance and Reform in the Southern Trust.
Ed McLean, Deputy Chief Executive and Director of Operations in the Public Health Agency.
Jason White, Assistant Director for Health and Wellbeing in the South Eastern Trust.
So I think when you see who has made the effort to turn up here, I think it's an indication of how seriously everyone in this room takes the healthcare provision within our entire district. I will be chairing the next public meetings and, of course, all the other meetings. But with it being Halloween, we didn't want to put this meeting off. But as I say, I have been booked to represent the council at another engagement. So I'll hand it over to Willie and to Johnny to start his presentation. Thank you.
Substance misuse, which compare those people to such areas. probably goes without saying, that's a pretty obvious fact, the rural nature of our district presents many challenges, particularly connecting vulnerable people with important public services. As health and well-being services begin to explore more innovative channels of service delivery, such as online GP consultation, this presents further challenges, not least in the area of broadband coverage, which you know has been picked up by members of many issues outside this particular forum. There's also issues shared around, I suppose, the recent strategic reviews for private health, be it content dollars and then go up, and they're all presenting significant challenges, specifically around the future configuration of important services, but also potentially what that may mean for local health facilities. So I suppose, Chair, within that context, that the desired outcomes around the health and well-being priorities within our plan have been selected. I'm supposed to not say I was dealing with the root cause of those issues, I suppose we'd be focusing on some of the more short-term things in the first instance. So then, Chair, maybe taking you on to that, what are those outcomes? Thank you very much, Chair, those indicators of what good looks like around health and well-being that we're trying to achieve. Well, Chair, to be aware that despite positive outcomes, we're schools working together underpin our community plan. However, the two that are most relevant to this meeting are, one, all people in Ewing Wynn Down getting started in life and fulfill their potential, and secondly, all people in Ewing Wynn Down enjoy good health and well-being. Below each of those positive outcomes are a number of priority areas which we have been working on actions to actually deliver those over the next couple of years. And they are, for example, in terms of a good start in life, level of early year support, whereby intervening early in terms of developmental support has been proven to be an important factor in securing improved levels of population well-being. That is particularly important when you look at factors such as birth weight, access to, for example, dental services, and the access to preschool support in formative years. The second area around the start of life is level of quality schooling. Although it maybe isn't particularly relevant to our partners with our working field today, but it's an important factor which will ultimately impact upon the health and well-being of those in our district. Particularly when you think about what educational attainment may mean in terms of life prospects and health of the individual. This is particularly important around mental health, where, for example, unresolved school bullying can have a detrimental and negative impact upon lifelong life as it is not resolved. There are also then shared issues around, for example, the level of preventable death. For example, we're working towards trying to achieve the main cause of those, for example, death in particular households, common cancers, heart disease, and suicide. There's also an indicator we like to look at, which is around the level of health status, where, for example, we can assess the quality of general living conditions in our district. Being able to preserve perceived health status is important for achieving our well-being elements, such as having good jobs and being able to participate in society, and also benefit from good education. So it's not only to share all about the what we call the direct health and intervention needed, but also secondary issues with new health impact upon the wider well-being of the district. And I suppose, Chair, if these positive outcomes that we've brought into focus in terms of what we've prepared around the National Action Plan and support of our community plan. So what are those? Well, in terms of our health and well-being delivery plan, members will be aware we agreed on the initial 2-year plan for the partner report back in June. And that will look at a series of actions which is supposed to begin to be able to underpin the delivery of those outcomes. For example, in early years, we are increasing access to early years support and preschool places and improved posting. Evidence is suggesting that there's actual general lack of awareness and information available to the public concerning those funding places that are available. So when you particularly think about those most deprived areas of the district, early and posting for potential users is something that we should be focusing on. In terms of family support, both moving better links between existing family support programs across statistics and social partners is a key priority which we're seeking to overtake. Evidence suggests there is limited, if any, joined up working in this area, resulting in potential duplication and deep gaps in service provision. In terms of mental and emotional health well-being, what we're seeking to do with our partners actually provide the mental and emotional health of the district and undertaking a survey, which will be widespread across key demographics and indeed each geography in our district. The results of which that may be seeking to, for example, develop an emotional resilience strategy, which will begin to put in place those actions to mitigate some of those more pressing issues around between mental and emotional well-being. The key one, I suppose, in terms of the role of the council phase, in terms of provisional leisure facilities, is physical activity. And what we're looking there is, in the next couple of years, exploring with our key staff partners the possibility of establishing school and K-12
community-based reward programs in terms of a priority around supported health and living, we've actually completed this task. We've mapped all the alcohol outlets across the district, and with the view now that having a discussion with key staff and partners about how we have to do dental coaches and interventions around dealing with particular substance issues across our district. And then around emergency response, which I know is the issue that members want to hear today, we are exploring with the Northern Ireland Fire and Rescue Service about extending what's called the delivered first response pregnancy to the district, where personnel from the Northern Ireland Fire and Rescue Service who are trained in cardiac events are actually able to respond with the Northern Ireland Government Service, particularly in Medicare response times, and that's what the team is able to have to be. In terms of the innovative board, just very briefly, with our partners, we're also looking at the innovative way of designing and delivering specific health interventions around some of the things that we've touched on. We've recently secured a mandate from the partnership board to begin to explore by our community budget concept, might be used, and how we might involve local people to decide where some small scale budgets might be spent in terms of supporting delivery of these outcomes. That's something that we'd like to support with you as politicians, so we're giving bringing out the effort to party reps for this next week to set out what that project is, for example, how members can get involved. Chair, I don't want to spend all the time because I know you want to focus a lot of your discussions with the partner. Whatever it is, does anybody have any questions? Maybe we can come up, Chair, at the meeting or raise everybody else.
Yeah.
Doing our responses or raising the future time. But I just want to give members a context of the post and like the conversations in South Korea.
All right, thanks very much for that, Johnny. We'll move on to the next presentation, and we're going to take all the questions at the end, or after all the presentations, so people keep in mind who they want to ask the questions to. So first up, very good agenda, sorry folks. South Eastern Health and Social Care Trust, it'll be Seamus. You're taking that.
Cheers, Willie. Good evening, everyone, and I must say I'm absolutely delighted to be here this evening. As a Director of Hospital Services, I see, as no doubt my colleagues will see, that year on year, demand continues to exceed the capacity we have, and in fact, the gap between what we have and what we actually need is getting bigger. So getting upstream is the fundamental approach that we need to adopt in a radical way, in a transformational way, in order to actually stop these increasing demands, or at least slow them down, and find a better way of delivering our health and social care. So for me, community planning and the focus on health and well-being absolutely has to be the starting place to make fundamental differences going forward. It will take some time. Rome was not built in a day, as we all know, but that is a critical starting point. So we really welcome this evening's meeting and the various events and meetings we've had with the various partners on community planning. What I plan to do is to just give you a very high-level set of responses to the written questions which we received last week. We have submitted written responses to those questions, and the council officers will circulate those to councillors, give you a chance to look at a bit more detail. And clearly, if you want to come back on any of those, we're more than happy to provide further information. But it is quite interesting that a lot of the questions you've been asking really are tapping into some of the very high-level issues that we're grappling with within the health and social care system. They're cutting across workforce issues, financial issues, demand and capacity issues, and a system that's really challenged in a way more than we've ever been. And for me, a lot of the things that we need to be focused on have been pointed to us by the various reports and reviews that have been undertaken in the past 3 years, be that the Donaldson Report or the Bangor Review or the Minister's strategy, stroke vision, I'm never sure which one it is, but about health and well-being delivering together. 2026. So, very interesting and important questions that you've asked, which will really bring out some of the major strategic issues. So, enhanced care at home, for example, I've decided to group some of our service development issues together to pick up some of your queries. We've had enhanced care at home on the North and Ireland side. That's starting to grow and develop, I have to say. We've a lot to learn from our Southern Trust colleagues for acute care at home, and we're picking up some of that learning, and we will actually be evolving our service. But we're wanting to introduce it into the Down and Lisburn areas as well. And we've been out to recruitment since February of this year, and it has been a struggle. Quite simply, you'll be aware that there's a national shortage and a regional shortage of nursing workforce and the vast majority of the staff we want to appoint for the service are nurses. Now, we're getting some successes now, but it's been really slow. But we do expect to start with the first couple of GP practices at the end of November, and we expect to roll out to the greater Down and Lisburn area across the early part of 2018. So, slow burn, but very much dependent on a workforce issue, which is a frustration for all of us because, to be frank, some of the decisions that were taken 7-8 years ago for financial reasons have left us with a workforce which is shorter than what we actually need. So that's one of the service development issues you've been interested in. You've also asked about what other plans we have for the Down Hospital. Well, we do have some plans, although I have to be frank with you. Those plans are plans at this moment in time, except for one, which is quite concrete. But they're also plans in the context of a financial system, which, again, is becoming more and more challenging. You will have seen the sorts of things that trusts were considering having to do as a result of delivering a £70 million savings just within the past couple of months. Well, no doubt you'll be well aware from the department's press release that next year we have a £430 million challenge just to stand still, and the year after that it rises to £670 million. So just imagine the scale of £70 million going to a figure which is probably going to be somewhere north of £300 million. Health needs about 5 or 6% every year to actually meet the demand. We probably get 2 to 3%. So even if we get 3% next year on a £5 billion budget, that's £150 million. That leaves a shortfall of £280 million. So four times what we were actually proposing in our consultation document this year. And a lot of that says to me, we urgently need to reform what we're doing. We can't sustain the current system that we have, and therefore it's going to be really difficult bringing new service developments into our local services. What I can say to you is on the good news front is we worked with the Belfast Trust, as did other trusts, to streamline the ophthalmology service across the region, and the Down Hospital is one of the spokes in the hub and spoke model, and we will be expanding our ophthalmology capacity in the Down next year. Other areas that we want to further develop, and at this stage where they are plans and they will be dependent on some income, but if we can get our enhanced care at home model in place next year, this will not depend on income because we want to bring that together with our frail elderly rapid assessment service, which is a fantastic service in the Down Hospital, and bring a more integrated approach to how we manage older people, generally with chronic conditions whose condition has been exacerbated. We're also doing some work to change how we deliver our cardiology services with a much more nurse-led focus. And I'm also pleased to report that we've managed to appoint a locum consultant who's working between the Ulster and the Down Hospital now, and that gives us a bit more stability on the cardiology front. Generally, where we can, we will seek out opportunities to expand our services. They will largely likely be in the areas of outpatients, day case work, and diagnostics, including if we can have an MRI scanner in the Down. We recognise that will be a modality of choice, but it is a very expensive piece of kit, so there's massive capital consequences and also revenue consequences. So whilst we have a very tough financial position ahead, we will still seek opportunities for expansion of services. Very briefly on the domiciliary care front, we have had quite a significant dependence on independent sector providers for domiciliary care. But actually, what we're trying to do now is grow more of our own and get a better balance. So we've recently held a number of open days where we have open recruitment sessions going. We've actually managed to interview and offer posts to a significant number that are on our waiting list. And we're very optimistic that we'll be able to actually start developing more of our in-house services. So whilst it's been difficult getting registered and trained staff, sometimes it can be more effective getting some of our domiciliary staff. And that's probably a first for us for some time. You did ask questions about how we assure ourselves about the quality of services. I can assure you that we have a core team, which is a domiciliary care hub, which is responsible for putting out referrals, make sure that they're picked up in a timely fashion, but they also have staff who are clearly working on the quality side of the service. Carrying out audits, responding to complaints. We have trust key workers who are actually connected to each of the domiciliary providers, and they're working very closely, getting user feedback to make sure that the quality of our services are up there with as good as the services they can possibly be. The rural issue has been a challenge in recent years, but what we're trying to do now is actually work with providers to create zones so that providers can't just pick and choose the contracts that they want. So they have to take a wider responsibility for a zone, which means, okay, those ones closer to Lisburn or the North Down side, well then, if you're North Down, you have to have responsibility for the peninsula all the way down. So we're trying to take this forward because we think rural Dunpatrick, rural Ards Peninsula, etc., we have a better chance of actually having a more equitable service. That's early days, but we're hoping for progress. And you also picked up the issue of flexibility around home care. Self-directed support is how we're actually trying to take that forward, where basically the user of the service, if they want and they're comfortable with it, they will have more responsibility for choosing the types of care that they want, and they can purchase that through a budgeting arrangement. Mental health was another area that you picked up, and understandably we all share concerns around the suicide levels within the region. And I think Northern Ireland now has the highest rates of suicide in the UK, which is particularly worrying. Interestingly, this year, the Down geographical area, whilst it has had an increase in suicide, the rate of increase has actually been less than it had been in the previous 3 years. Now, we will not console ourselves with any slight increase, but there has been some really good work done between the Trust with local and regional initiatives, be they Zero Suicide or the Protecting Life Strategy. And we're working with our partners in the PHA and the PSNI, particularly when we have trends and patterns which actually require a community response plan. And so I think we become better at picking up on those issues and addressing them as a multi-agency approach. Self-harm is another area that we've particularly focused on, and you've also asked about the possibilities of having a safe zone for patients who have acute mental health. We do have assessment centres across the Trust open every day from 9 o'clock in the morning to 8 p.m. at night, and we have our emergency services and home treatment services as well. And by and large, the majority of patients who present in crisis tend not to be suicidal. So, again, we're not taking that lightly, but we're not convinced that a safe zone would be appropriate for many of those patients. So it's trying to get that balance between patients who wouldn't require a safe zone and those that absolutely must. And that becomes a professional decision-making process. You've asked questions of ourselves around the digital systems. I know you've asked some of the questions to Southern Trust colleagues. And each trust operates actually hundreds of digital systems to improve our management of patients and clients. And by and large, the vast majority of those systems are common across the health and social care family. The one thing that is kind of over all of this is the Northern Ireland Electronic Care Record, which allows professionals across primary care, secondary care, different trusts to actually access information about patients and clients in a timely fashion, even if that information or that context is history of the patient has been taken elsewhere, for example. So that's an approach which is across secondary care, primary care, mental health, community services. And really what we're trying to do as a system is get a better approach to those hundreds of digital platforms that exist and bring that under one umbrella. So the Health and Social Care Board, along with colleagues from PHA, Department, and all the trusts have been working together on a major, I would call it an IT program, but it's not an IT program, it's a major change program, which is going to deliver a system to help us record and manage our patients under largely one major system, which allows for effective communication across the system. The project's called the Encompass Program, and it will be quite a significant investment of hundreds of millions of pounds over the next 10 years. And we would expect that system to be in place by 2025 at the latest, but with the starts of the program probably a couple of years earlier. So there's quite a lot of work being done on the IT and systems front, including home monitoring of patients through telecare, so be assured that we take every opportunity we can to use technology to keep our patients at home. Very briefly on a few points that you picked up, Jason, my colleague, will shortly pick up on smoking cessation along with other issues. You did ask about reductions in outpatients through the month of July. You're absolutely right. We actually see fewer outpatients in July than any other month of the year, but actually we tend to book fewer patients at bank holidays, Easter, Christmas, and with the July fortnight being quite a popular holiday period within Northern Ireland, we take that into account so that we're actually planning our clinics on the basis of availability of staff as well as patients. So July does tend to be a lighter month in terms of the patients, but be assured, by the time we get to the end of August and September, we've caught up on a lot of the patients who wouldn't have been accessing care in July. The Good Morning Down service, just to be very clear, along with many other voluntary services, we will be providing funding up to the end of the year. We couldn't confirm that funding because we were in the middle of our savings consultation period, but now that has been completed and we're in a position now to write out to all of the bodies who we fund, and Good Morning Down service will have their funding right up to the 31st of March, and we'll do the usual annual review of contracts. And very briefly, and no doubt Shane will probably pick up on this, you did ask a hugely important question about the ambulance service and our ability or otherwise to have a negative impact on Shane's crews when they're bringing patients, particularly from the Downpatrick area, or right down to Newcastle, up to the Ulster Hospital, for example. We understand that, to some extent, when we're not getting the crews turned over in a timely fashion, that means less availability for the population of the greater Downpatrick area, and we're very, very clear about that. What are we doing to address it? Well, one of the biggest problems we face at the Ulster is that demand for emergency care has exceeded capacity, and the increase we've had in emergency admissions over the past 5 years is actually three times the average rate of increases in the rest of the UK. So there's been an exponential growth, which meant we're always playing catch up. So we're doing further work to actually improve our capacity, better use the capacity we have, and also we're working very closely with the ambulance service. We're hoping to have a second hospital liaison officer in the Ulster, which will mean a 7-day service. That role is really valued and can help the management of patients and the timeliness of handover. When we build our brand new emergency department, and it'll be open in 2020 at the Ulster, as our second part of our second block, there will be a dedicated area for a handover from NIAS with dedicated staff, and that will allow the crews to take away much more quickly. But we're not waiting until the new building comes along. We are working with the ambulance service this winter to put an interim scheme in place, which will allow for quicker handover. So that's all I wanted to say in respect of the particular queries that you've asked from the Trust. As I say, we have submitted a written response, and feel free to ask for further details if you need to. I'm now going to ask Jason White, who's the Assistant Director in the South Eastern Trust for Health and Wellbeing, and Jason's going to share with you some of the local issues that we've been taking forward very much under that umbrella. Thank you.
Thank you, Seamus, and thank you for the opportunity to talk to him this evening. I would like to build on what Seamus has said, but also on what Johnny said in his presentation about the importance of community planning and working together to improve the health and wellbeing of the population across the entire council area. To do that, I'm going to kind of refer, I left copies for each of you in terms of a short document we produced to highlight some of the initiatives that are going on in the some of the down area within the council. This seeks to improve health and wellbeing and reduce health inequalities, and that includes a range of smoking cessation services, particularly in hospital settings. As you can see in this document, the initiatives are linked to the draft programme for government in terms of giving the child the best start in life, healthy lives and so on, and that's important in terms of outlining our contribution to those important outcomes. And as you can see from this, there's lots of important or exciting initiatives that are ongoing just now in the Down area. Is making a real difference to the lives of vulnerable children, adults and older people. And I know that there's similar initiatives going on in the Southern Trust in Uring Mourne in partnership with our colleagues in the Public Health Agency. And going forward, what we're keen to do is to work ever closer with the council through the community planning framework to extend and enhance these services to make more of a difference to the health and well-being of our citizens that we serve. We could really make a big difference if we work together to address some of these difficult issues. Some of the issues we are facing are tricky. There's no easy solutions, and the more partners that can put their arms to the wheel, the better. And in the document, you'll see there's a number of kind of pink boxes, and those boxes outline potential projects that we could develop together under the community planning banner. And just for kind of illustration, I can talk through a few of these and to show you what kind of things we're thinking of. So as you can see in the front cover, there's the Daily Mile. There's over 6,000 children running a mile every day, and we know that early intervention, getting kids active, is a huge part of their later health outcomes and life expectancy. But that 6,000 could easily be 20,000. We know many politicians sit in boards of governors and so on. If we all work together, we could get more schools and down, more Nurean and more involved in that important initiative. Another initiative we have is called Care in Communities, and this delivers a service to socially isolated older people. We know there are more older people, but also because family dynamics are not what they were in the past. Families live in different parts of the country or different countries. So there's many older people, particularly in Down, and imagine the same in Ewing Mourn, who are isolated in their communities, who maybe don't see another human soul week on week. You know, we've heard stories of older people who write letters to themselves just so the postman walks up their driveway so they can have a wee chat. And we have a service whereby we recruit and we manage volunteer befrienders. So again, there's lots of people who retire and looking for something to do and who are very keen to volunteer. But that's a service where we know there's 106 isolated older people are waiting for that volunteer befriender. If we work together, we could recruit a lot more of those volunteer defenders that would make a real difference to those isolated older people. And that's something concrete that we could do in the next 2-3 years, try and address that need. A final example relates to the other side of the spectrum, which is our children and young people. So we have over 500 children in care in the Southeastern Trust. There's a similar number in the Southern Trust. And we know those children and young people we all have a responsibility for under corporate parenting. So as local government and national government, we are kind of collectively responsible. And those children have the poorest outcomes. They experience the worst health inequalities. But again, that's an opportunity for us to do something different, to work collectively in a different way. As a health trust, we can only do so much. We can achieve so much more if we work in partnership through community planning. To give you an example, Heather McKee, who many of you I'm sure know, who's Johnny's predecessor, is now in Southeastern Regional College, and we have a scheme in Downpatrick whereby we're trying to get young people in care into taster sessions between the ages of 13 and 15. So they experience a bit of college life, build their aspiration, they get to know what college is all about, and they think, you know what, college can be for me, and I want to do well in my GCSEs, my levels to get into college. So those are kind of initiatives we could do together. So I hope that's been useful in terms of a summary of how we want to move forward on the community planning. And just to emphasise what Seamus and Johnny both said, that health service is important, but also health and well-being in terms of our citizens, how they feel and the differences we can make in terms of their status going forward. So thank you for your time.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. And in the interest of time, I know there's been a lot said that is equally as appropriate to the Southern Trust as it is to the Southeastern Trust. So it's not my intention to repeat that, because there's a lot of the work that we do together and with the Council that I think has been very explicitly explained. But there was just a few things that I wanted to pick up in relation to some of the issues that were raised about the Southern Trust. And again, we do have a draft written response to all of those queries, but if I could just maybe very quickly run through some of the themes that were picked up, it might be helpful. One of them was about agency nursing staff and the number of agency nursing staff that we used across the hospital sites. So just to be clear, that at the moment we use approximately 27 whole-time equivalent qualified nursing staff and 13 support staff. Now, if you put that against our the number of staff in the trust, the number of nursing staff in the trust, which is actually 5,000 staff. So you can imagine it's just compared to that, it's a small number. However, that is important that we, for us to maintain the quality of care. So therefore, it's not acceptable to me or any other member of staff in the Southern Trust that we would leave any team or ward without sufficient staff to cover. Having said that, and as Seamus had said already, there are significant challenges around workforce, particularly around nursing, and we can maybe talk a little bit about that later, and particularly around medical staff. But it was just that specific question was asked, and it was asked specifically also about Daisy Hill. So approximately 7 of those staff, agency nursing staff, work in Daisy Hill Hospital. Another little bit of background is just, it was about the number of permanent staff in Daisy Hill, and in this past 3 years we have increased the number of permanent qualified nursing staff by 73 whole-time equivalents, and the number of unqualified or support staff by 27. So there's about an increase in approximately 100 staff in Daisy Hill Hospital. Another question was around staff being redeployed. Now again, we would sometimes on occasion ask staff to go and work in different areas. That is again about patient safety. So if a staff, if a ward or department has more staff than they need on a particular day, our senior nursing people, one of who's sitting beside me, would ask other staff to go and work in areas that don't have sufficient nursing staff. So, but that's not on a permanent basis. And indeed, the question was asked about Daisy Hill. We have not redeployed any staff from Daisy Hill. In actual fact, it's the other way around. They come from Craigavon to Daisy Hill. So I just wanted to clarify that for you. The other issue around acute care at home, a critical care at home, as it's called in some other areas, again, Seamus alluded to that. We have that in all areas of the trust except for the Newry and Mourne area. We did go out to advertise earlier this year and we were unsuccessful. We're out to advertisement again and have actually reshaped the requirements for that service. So in terms of medical and nursing staff, we believe and are more confident that we will get that team in place in early January, February of 2018. So it's just, I just want to be clear, it's not that we didn't advertise for that service to be in that area. We did, but we're unsuccessful. We couldn't attract the nursing or medical staff. So we're more confident, and indeed it is an excellent service, and that's why I think now that medical and nursing staff are more keen to go and work in that service. That service, just so as you know, provides a huge number of activities that previously would have been administered in a hospital. So for instance, blood transfusions, those things that actually couldn't have been done in someone's home before, all of that acute medical care, antibiotic, IV therapies, all of those things we can do now in people's homes, which is what they want. Actually, nobody wants to be in a hospital. This is what our patients and clients are telling us, unless they absolutely have to be. So it's a very, very well-run and effective service, and we hope to have that fully installed in the Newry and Mourne area early next year. There were a number of issues around telehealth, telecare. Again, I'm not going to go into that. I think that actually Seamus is very eloquently, probably more than I could, explain to it how the electronic healthcare record and the Encompass project is going to take all of those forward. The one thing I would say, and that Johnny made reference to earlier, was the whole issue around broadband, and across the entire, all of our trust areas and council areas, the more we can do to work together means we can expand that much more quickly. We can expand to what we know as electronic healthcare records in people's homes. The reason why we can't do that at the moment is because in some of these areas, and we're all well aware of this, my own home included, the broadband cover is just diabolical. So we need to work as a council, as trusts, and as partners to try to improve that so that we can get that e-health way of working spread throughout the entirety of our council and trust areas. There were a lot of issues around dementia care, and again, we have a very specific trust care support team which monitors the care and actually inputs into the care of all dementia patients across all of our nursing homes and domiciliary care providers. So the trust have actually developed that to assist those staff who sometimes experience difficulty in looking after the complex needs of dementia care sufferers. And indeed, as you know, our trust is no different to any other trust. There are huge changes in our demography. We have in the Southern Trust area, and indeed it's closely followed by Seamus in the South Eastern Trust, the highest number of older people and the highest number of younger people, growing population in our trust. So that is a huge challenge for us, and therefore along with that comes a larger number of people with dementia, and actually a larger number, unfortunately now, of people with dementia who are under 65 years of age, not over 65 years of age, which I'm sure all of you are very much aware of as well. I'm just trying to... There was a lot of other questions around e-health. There was stuff around carers assessments, and indeed our trust would have regionally, again with Seamus's, the highest number of people who are offered carers assessments. We contract with organisations such as CAUSE and a lot of Aware Defeat Depression, a lot of other companies that actually look after the physical health needs of people, to provide carers assessments, and indeed to help carers to help them to cope with the needs of their particular relatives. Health care packages, again, reliance on the private sector providers, and again Seamus touched on that. We have a difficulty, there's no point in me denying that. We do compete with, in terms of workforce, with our commercial sector. So in actual fact, a lot of people would say to us, and I'm just being perfectly honest with you, Francis, we'd rather go and work in Tesco actually than be trotting around the country at all hours of the day and night, because it's an easier job. We don't have to use our own transport. We can go in and do our day's work. We don't be worrying about all these people with problems. So therefore what we're doing is try to work together with the Department of Health, with our care providers, to make those jobs more attractive. And indeed what we also have done within the trust, and I know Seamus has done within his trust as well, is to provide a lot more training and workforce opportunities. So therefore some of our domiciliary care providers, we have then gone on to offer them open university programs to become qualified nurses after a period of time. So it's trying to make that job more attractive. It is not an attractive job, and there's no, I would be dishonest if I was sitting in front of you here tonight and saying it's a job that we have hundreds of people applying for, because we simply don't. So as Seamus was saying, there's lots of things that we're trying to do to make that more attractive. GP out of hours facilities, again the question was asked how many times, how many occasions in the last 12 months have in a particular area around Kilkeela and Newry, have those services been unavailable, and four times in this past 12 months that has been the case. But I have to be honest and say to you, GP out of hours is very unattractive for GPs, and we're working with the board and the PHA and indeed the department to try and make that more attractive. It's not only within the southern area, it is very attractive across unattractive across all of the trusts, and there are occasions whenever we do struggle to cover shifts. Now, there never is not a GP out of hours service, and you always can access by telephone and be triaged. However, sometimes if we just cannot, for instance, on the four occasions in this past 12 months we couldn't get any GPs, you may be asked to travel to a different out-of-hours facility. But it's not that you wouldn't have access to out-of-hours, you just might have to travel to that if you need to, and you will always have access to someone calling you back and triaging you as well. Again, up to some of stuff around digital systems. There was a question around the Daisy Hill Pathfinder Group, and I think a number of people in this room I know have been involved in the work going on around Daisy Hill Pathfinder Group, and that has been, in my view, to this date, been a very successful example of co-production and co-design. We are now going on to develop a model, not only for the Daisy Hill ED department, but for the Daisy Hill and indeed the Cute Hospital services, because that is something most definitely that is going to have to change over the next number of years. As Seamus has said, this year has been particularly difficult in terms of finance. Next year and the following year are going to be more difficult. There simply isn't enough money in the health service unless somebody can do something to get money elsewhere to provide the health service that people require and indeed demand these days. So, as Seamus says, the demand outstrips our capacity. And there are a couple of things that I would like to say. Given the increase in demographics, which is the number of younger people, older people, that puts a huge demand on our services, and that's why we're trying to develop alternatives that actually are better for people in the community, like acute care at home, like our frail elderly assessment service, like our respiratory services. Over the winter we have a huge number of people, particularly not only older people, but who come with respiratory problems, end up in hospital and can be there for a number of years. So we're trying to do all of those things, build up our community services to enable people to go back home, not to have to come into hospital. If they come to an ED department, we will have increased what we call ambulatory care services, which means if you need to be assessed or treated or diagnosed, all of that's done there. We don't take you into hospital to do it and stay there for a week, and then you develop a chest infection and everything else you get, because remember, hospitals are the most unsafe places to be, and the research would suggest if you're over 70 years of age, you shouldn't come anywhere near a hospital because you're actually prone to getting many more things through no one's fault. However, we're trying to do that to make those services more readily available in the community. And I think it's important to note that actually we spend over 60% of our budget in community services, not hospital services. And if I were to build another 4 wards onto each of our hospitals, and I can tell you this time next year, we would still be sitting with the same problem. The future is not about beds, it's about how we do things differently, how we train doctors and nurses and indeed other people to do things differently, how we skill them up to ensure that we move away from intervention, which is what we do now. We do things to people, take them into hospital and do a whole lot of examinations and tests and all of that, to moving towards prevention, which is what Johnny was saying earlier, were in terms of older people, younger people, middle-aged people. We actually help them to live healthier lives so that when they get older, they don't have 2 or 3 or 4 or indeed 5 different diseases, which is what we're currently experiencing at this point in time. So that's what we're trying to move towards. That's what community planning is all about. And it's not about the council's community plan, it's about my community plan, working with the council, working with housing, working with the police, working with education. It's about everybody working together to ensure we have a population in Northern Ireland, but particularly in these council areas, that are educated about their health and well-being, how to keep themselves healthier in the future. Because all the research, I don't need to tell you, around diabetes, obesity, suicide, all of those things at the moment, we cannot cure with hospital beds. We need to adopt a different approach, and that's about you and I, indeed everybody in this room and everybody outside of it, with our communities working together to make that better. So I hope that sort of put things in context. There's a whole lot of other things that Seamus covered extremely well that are as applicable for the Southern Trust as they are for the South Eastern Trust. And of course, we're happy to take questions whenever, you know, we get to that stage.
Okay, thanks, Francis. Next presentation is the presentation from NI Ambulance Service. Shane, you're presenting.
Thank you very much. again, like the others, we have a response, a written response, and actually one of the questions you've asked for is quite a lot of data. And again, we have that. I'm more than happy to share all the data. I suppose what I'd like to do is put a little bit of context on what we're trying to change in NIAS, and therefore the impact that might have or will have on your population. A little bit of background, the model for responding in terms of ambulance response was designed in 1974, which is quite a long time ago, and basically responses to ambulances are on 3 categories. There's that which is emergency and life-threatening, there's that which is still an emergency but is not life-threatening, and that which is considered urgent. And those 3 categories are category A, B and C. So as part of preparing for today, you'd asked me to look at considerable data around how are we performing. Category A calls are those that I said are emergency and life-threatening, and everywhere in the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland, up until very recently, monitored those against an 8-minute target. So can we get to a patient that is both life-threatening and emergency with 8 minutes? It is clear that in this particular council area and other rural areas, we are not regularly able to hit that, and the average is considerably higher than 8 minutes. So in the 3 months I looked at for today, the average is in around 14 minutes, and that's not acceptable. Category B, which are those that are considered to be urgent but not life-threatening, is a target of 21 minutes. On an average, we're hitting 20 minutes. So those Category Bs we are hitting. And Category C are those that are considered non-emergency but are still quite urgent. So it could be lower gastric pain or various things like that. Things that nobody, unfortunately, thank God, is going to die from, but clearly is a need. If you take those three categories, then what's happening, and it's happened in the rest of the United Kingdom, is what we're trying to do, which is actually, when you take a call, and to give you an example, we across Northern Ireland take 210,000 emergency calls a year. We are categorising about 30% of those in Category A, so life-threatening emergency. And what evidence is showing now is that they are not life-threatening nor emergency, and only about 7% of those are. And that's a really important factor for us improving the service for rural areas. Because if we are sending life-threatening ambulances on flashing blue lights to people who do not need an ambulance and flashing blue lights, then when the next call comes in for someone who does need it, it will not be there. And therefore, what the rest of the United Kingdom have done has moved to a clinical outcome-based approach, not a time-based approach, and that is what we intend to do. Because what we need to do is get an ambulance there to the sickest quickest, and then take the appropriate time to get the right resource to the rest of the patients. And what they're beginning to discover in England, and they went live with this 3 months ago, is that it's making a huge difference to those who are both life-threatening and an emergency, but it is also making a difference to the other categories as well. So, for us, when we start to look at what's happening in rural areas, we have to change our services, what we're planning to do, to really focus in on the true Category A's, which we'll now call Category 1's, which are the real life-threatening and the real urgent patients. What that will mean is that those who are having cardiac arrest or those with a major stroke will be in that category, but there will be other people. For example, the one category that now will be Category 2 would be the football injury on the football pitch. Someone, a major fracture, hugely painful. But actually, is it life-threatening? No, it's not life-threatening. It is hugely painful, and we need to get the appropriate resource, but actually, that won't be in the top category, because actually we're going to focus on those who have cardiac arrest, who are unconscious on breathing. So we're starting to look at how do we categorise patients, because we know that the biggest risk is in that Category 1, those life-threatening, and it is obvious, we can see from the numbers, that in this particular council area and other rural areas, we are unable to regularly hit those Category A's, because we are actually attending, as a Category O, those things that aren't a Category A, and that's a really important change. So, massive bit of research has gone into this. We've worked with other ambulance services across the United Kingdom, and we're starting to put plans in place to change the way we respond to calls, to free up calls for those really, really urgent. Two things running alongside that. The other thing then is what this research has shown is there are a number of things that we are not as efficient as other ambulance services, and we are working on those, and one of those is turnaround times, as Seamus has mentioned. We have a real challenge with turnaround times in a number of our hospitals, so we have a number of people who are starting to work with the other trusts to develop appropriate and new turnaround processes. And actually some of the hospitals in Northern are very good at turnarounds. They have dedicated receival units that have dedicated staff that can deal, take our patients quickly, and we can then get back out on the road again. And then the third element, which is probably the one that will be hardest to deliver, is in fact we need resources. And that's what both Seamus and Francis have talked about. The piece of research that we've done in partnership with the Welsh Ambulance Service, the Scottish Ambulance Service, and seven other ambulance services in England, shows that if we do not invest in greater numbers of ambulances and paramedics, that this trend of poor performance in Category A will continue. And we've mapped that through, and it numerically says that if we are to meet the 1, 2 and 3, the A, B and C, for the whole of Northern Ireland by 2021, we need 330 more qualified paramedics or emergency medical technicians. Now, we know that in the current economic climate, there isn't somebody standing there with a checkbook for me with 331 additional staff. But if we can start to change our processes, we have, and focus on the really sick, we have a greater chance of reducing life, reducing risk, and increasing life. We would, of course, wish to try to explore how we can resource the health services fully and resource the ambulance service, this unit of 330 people. But realistically, I think that is not going to suddenly happen overnight. So we've packaged all that up, and you can have a look at all that. A couple of other things that you raised. One was about the helicopter emergency medical service, the HEM service. And the question is that taking resources away from frontline ambulance crews? It's a completely different cabinet, treasury-led resource. But what I would say is all of the staff that we have released to be part of that service, so all of the staff who work in the helicopter emergency medical service are still NIAS staff. All of those who've been released to work on that are being re-resourced and refunded, so we haven't lost any staff whatsoever to the service. We've enhanced the service to match against the loss that we had. And also in the question about the HEM service, how do we allocate calls? It's totally integrated in with NIAS. So our HEMS paramedics, our HEMS call receivers, which we call emergency medical dispatchers, are listening to all calls and are saying that one's a possible one for HEMS, or that one is a road crew. So it's integrated into that rather than being in competition from that. And the third area then you asked me about was private ambulances. Yes, as an organisation, as a health and social care system, we do use private ambulances. It is a small area, so to put it into context, we try strongly not to use them for emergency work, as you can appreciate, because what we're looking at is qualified, highly qualified paramedics, etc. So in this particular council area, in the area Moreland Down, I think it was over the last quarter, and I'll just double check that, I think we used 211 private ambulances. So if you think about the sheer volume of activity that NIAS does, there were 211 private ambulance journeys used over that period. As I say, compared to the total amount of ambulance journeys that we do, which is, 197,000 per annum. So work that out in terms of monthly and work, it's a small fraction. But yes, we do. And in many cases, it's better to use a private ambulance to support discharge from hospital, and that should allow some of our crews to get on with dealing with the urgent and emergency work. So, and then the very, very final thing was the query with regards to our fleet. And the question was about our fleet and the quality of our fleet. Our ambulance fleet is the envy of all the rest of the ambulance services in the United Kingdom. We have no vehicles over the age of 5 years old, which is quite rare, and has been fully funded by the Department of Health for the last, I think, 7 years now. And we again have another funded that's streamed this year to replace all the ambulances that would tip over the 5 year barrier this year. So fleet is the envy actually of everything else in the UK and Ireland actually as well. So, but as I say, happy, we have it in written form and happy to share that.
Okay, thanks very much, Stu. Before I take the questions, I'll take apologies. This was remiss of me not to take apologies earlier. And the old one. That counts as Alvin's holidays, is it? Okay, members, we're going to move to our questions and I need your cooperation here so we can keep the meeting flowing. We'll have one opportunity to ask your questions and direct your question when you're making your point or asking your question, directed to who you want the answer from. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a group of three at a time to ask your questions, and then after the answers I'll allow one supplementary if you want to come back on that, and I think that'll give everybody a fair opportunity. If there's something that comes back from the presenters that you're not quite happy with, then you'll have an opportunity to ask that question. Okay, members, I'll take the first three, and Councillor Walker.
Chair, thank you very much. First of all, I would like to thank you for coming along tonight. These are well represented, and I hope that we can form first and foremost, a good working relationship with the two trusts. You know, in the past, from old council days, it used to be yous and us. I would like to think it's all of us in this together. You've seen our community plan there, what Johnny has stated. We're in this together, so we are. You know, it's not using us. We're in this together, and I hope we do form a good working relationship, and you always have a strong team coming to the meetings, so you do. Because at the end of the day, the winners out there will be our constituents, so they will, in relation to it. So we welcome you along tonight. I'm looking forward as a councillor working with you in the future. And my questions would be more to Seamus in relation to... Seamus, you've mentioned that you're working up a few plans for the Down Hospital and that. So you are. Well, hopefully, I'm looking forward to them being implemented. So you are. And I hope you do keep councillors informed of what they all are. You know, what services, additional services and that's going to go into the Down and that. Because we are passionate about the Down. You know, I'm still concerned about accident and emergency in the Down, because I had the unfortunate situation where I had to go to the Ulster on a couple of occasions, and it was like a war zone, the accident and emergency. So it was at 11 o'clock at night. So it was, and I just said to myself, look, you know, if accident and emergency in the Down had been open, I knew a number of people there that night from this area. And on one of the occasions, grandchild of mine had to bypass the Down from Ardglass to go to the Ulster, and I am concerned that we haven't got our full accident and emergency restored to the Down. Now, you mentioned the Ulster and the new build. I would be a wee bit wary in that sense. Now, while I would welcome any new build, you know, are the trusts not putting all their eggs in one basket? Everything seems to centre around the Ulster Hospital, and that when we have a perfectly good hospital up behind us here. And I would be a wee bit concerned further down the line, in a few years' time, if major cuts have to be made, that the hospital that would be sacrificed would be the Down Hospital over Dundonald, because all the eggs have been placed in the one basket there at the Ulster Hospital. And finally, I think we should be, in relation to mental health, I think that is a big, big issue in our district, right across, not just our district, but the whole province. And I think a lot more has to be done to try and find finances to finance mental health more. So we do, you know, we need to go knocking on the doors. Well, it's permanent secretaries or whoever they are, well, it's a minister, a direct rule minister or whoever. We need to be going and we need to be knocking and saying we need this money, because it is a major issue, so it is within our district.
Right, thanks, Councillor Walker. Councillor Riley.
Thanks, Chairman. I'll try and be as quick as I can here. Mine is primarily aimed at the Southern Trust, even though my electoral ward combines both. I'm sure Willie will be able to speak very well for the Eastern. But firstly, the sleeve row, which has been an ongoing issue. I had an issue at the weekend where an elderly person was trying to get a home care package and considered respite, but it's completely and absolutely at capacity now. There's no respite beds in use, and all the beds are taken up. And it's just in what Seamus said about in-house domiciliary care. I didn't hear you mention that. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Francis. I didn't hear you mention or put any degree of emphasis on that. And I think that is important, that we build up that and not put everything into the private sector basket. Excuse me. The GP issue, you know, speaking to GPs within our area, they tell me that it's almost impossible to get a locum to come in and cover for them, to get off for a few days, leave or whatever. Is there anything the Trust can do about that, or is that outside your responsibility? Paramedics, first responders, are we doing anything on that in the morning area? Now, the last time I brought this up, some of the ambulance people actually jumped down my throat and said, what are you doing after you're, you know, we don't want that. We just want the ambulance service as the single provider. So, but yet, on the ground, there are people who, very, very highly skilled ex-military, have been in Afghanistan battle situations, you know, first-class paramedics who would be willing to do that type of work, and certainly they would be, you know, they could serve the whole community well. Community first aid. I renewed my HGV license just to have it there quite recently, and I was surprised at the degree of emphasis put on first aid now for drivers and, you know, being able to do that. And I think if there was more that could be done within the community through the trust to encourage, you know, first aid, I think would be an advantage to the whole community. And can I just say, I've been doing a bit of research on the NHS recently and the cost and whatever, and I was absolutely surprised. You know, if you aggregate what happens here in Scotland, England and Wales, if you aggregate all their returns, whatever, the NHS for the UK is still the premier health provider in the whole of the world. It's incredible. And a lot less amount of GDP than in Germany and all these other developed countries. So I'm astounded to people like you that are managing that and keeping that going. Sometimes we're really hard on you, but I'm sure you're going to appreciate, you know, whenever we're getting that tough, we pass that on. But I would just thank you for the work that you do. And I really do mean that. It's a very, very difficult task, and you are managing well with what you have. So thanks very much.
Thanks, Councillor Andrews.
Thank you very much, John. Firstly, I would like to take the opportunity of thanking the representatives from the Southern Trust, the Ambulance Service and the South Eastern Trust for coming along to give the councillors a presentation on your reports and on your on what you are proposing to go ahead with over the next year or two. You know, I'd say you've touched upon a lot of points that are very relevant to this present moment in time, from mental health, you know, addiction, suicide prevention and awareness right across the board. But, you know, Seamus, whenever you touched on, could you take on board the need and demand, the likes of an MRI scan for the Down Hospital, as you know, in relation to the area that the Down Hospital would serve, you know, and especially, you know, in relation to contractual issues. We've touched on this at previous meetings here before, whereas the likes of doctors can pick and choose and say, for example, I'm not going to Down Hospital to work, I'm going to go somewhere like Royal Victoria or the Ulster Hospital to gain more experiences. So, I know in the old days, if you were told to go somewhere, you went there where you liked it a lot. But, you know, as you say, that's the point of raising contractual issues. And, you know, as my colleague touched on the Ulster Hospital, I've been there myself, I had taken an elderly relative down to the Ulster Hospital, and honest to God's truth, you thought you were in Korea, you know, in a battle zone with the place that packed the doors. And I say, I must compliment the staff who have worked under so much pressure. They deserve medals. You know, in relation to the, when you're talking about the opening, we've seen a lot of new building in the Ulster Hospital. That's very impressive, very nice looking. And you were talking about another bit of new building on. You know, considering the money that's going to be spent on that, you know, why can we not consider the down public A&E, why can it not be considered? You know, the money that could be saved in that new build at the Ulster Hospital could be channeled into other services elsewhere that are screaming for cash, you know. And also, whenever you have patients in from this area, why not send them back from the Ulster Hospital to the Down to convalesce, henceforth freeing up a lot of space in the Ulster Hospital, you know. And I do welcome the major investments, and it will probably due to the uncertainties in the budgets, your hands are to a certain extent are tied, and you just don't know what way these are going, but hopefully more can be done to deliver a first-class service, which at present is under so much pressure. But another wee subject that's very close to my heart in relation to care for our elderly. You get people that work hard all their lives, scrimp and saving a few bob, and then end up in their residential home. And what happens is, to pay for care in residential homes, properties, etc., are being sold, and people being under pressure to find top-up fees to pay for care, you know. And I think personally that it's wrong that people should be under so much pressure. And maybe as part of the strategy, it could be devised that maybe a fair package could be put in line for people who work hard all their lives, ending up getting their clocks cleaned by having to go into residential homes and ending up with nothing. But I know your hands are tied to that legislation, but it's probably subject to look address. But that's just my details. And last but not least, to the ambulance service, I'd like to thank you, first of all, that you're still under that much pressure. But some concerns that were raised to me is the recent campaign with FAST, with the stroke campaign. In a lot of our areas, which was rural, you know, and ambulance cover, the ambulance crews are stretched. For example, if you have let's say also a hospital full to capacity, and you have a line of ambulances lined up and can't go nowhere because they can't get their patients processed, you know, that's another thing that we need to look at is ambulance care and provision. I know that you're aware of that, but I think that's all for me.
Keep the light on, Councillor Andrews, because if there's a supplementary coming back, we haven't got the light system right.
Thank you very much, sir.
If Councillor Walker comes back, we can use your mic. First one's Councillor Walker, was about the Ulster Hospital. Councillor Andrews as well, about issues about the Ulster Hospital and mental health. Thank you, Councillor Walker. Was
okay, I'm happy to pick up on Councillor Walker's and Councillor Andrews' issues at the same time. I suppose the first thing I would say is absolutely we need to keep you informed about plans that we have for the hospital. I do think that actually we talked to each other better than we did in the past, and we need to build on that. So absolutely, that's for us to continue to share with you our plans. And some of those plans are very concrete, like ophthalmology. It will be happening, and we're delighted about that. Others, we're still working hard to try and make the case and secure the funding, be it MRI or some of those other things. I understand your concern about access to emergency care, and the reality is, because of the changes we had to make in respect of our ED and the Down, that has put more pressure on the Ulster Hospital, amongst many other things. The biggest challenge for the Ulster has been, as I say, that growth in emergency admissions, which is three times the average growth in the UK for the past 5 years. Now, in raw numbers terms, there used to be 16,500 emergency admissions at the Ulster Hospital in 2010-11. Now there's over 25,000 emergency attendances. So that's over 8,000 of an increase. And to put it in bed terms, we would have needed another 160 beds to deal with that. We got 40 beds. So you can imagine the pressure that's on the system. Now, there's no consolation to any individual who has to wait for any length of time to get access to emergency care in the Ulster Hospital. But just to reassure you, patients are being seen in a timely fashion. You will really look at the department statistics, and the Ulster Hospital is amongst the best performing hospitals in terms of ED for when you first seen by a doctor. We have excellent turnaround times on average for the majority of our patients. For those patients waiting for a bed, that can be more challenging. And we look at a range of quality indicators across all of our hospitals, and the College of Emergency Medicine have many indicators. A couple of those are indicators of whether people are getting a good quality service and they're getting it first time round. So, for example, the College of Emergency Medicine would say no more than 5% of your patients should be an unplanned reattender, i.e. they've been to the ED, you've dealt with them, and they've had to come back within a period of time. Well, the Ulster Hospital performs at less than 3%. So even though it's a hugely pressured department, they deliver a first-class quality service. Where we as a system are challenged is, how can we support better access to beds, primarily for those patients who are waiting for access to care? I could start on a whole other area around increase in demand, but also challenges about timely discharge from hospital for patients who require social complex care. And the issue that Francis has talked about around domiciliary care, for example, it has been a challenge. So the Ulster Hospital serves the South Eastern Trust and the Belfast Trust. And today, for example, at lunchtime, there were 45 patients in the Ulster waiting for discharge in the community package. Now, more than half of those have been waiting for longer than the 48 hours, which is the target, and many of those have been waiting for longer than 7 days because there isn't enough capacity in our community as well as our hospitals. I say no consolation to any individual who's to wait for a lengthy time, but our system is hugely challenged, and that's why we need to reform. And maybe just on the rebuilding of the hospital, I suppose I should remind Council, we got a brand new spanking Down hospital built in 2009, and I suppose it's a bit like Craigavon's waiting for theirs. I'm sure Francis can't wait for the investment.
there's a series of developments going around the region. It was the Ulster's town, effectively, because it was in, I suppose, a critical state from a physical perspective. Hospital designed in the 50s, built in the 60s, actually has concrete cancer. So it is actually falling down, and if it's not replaced, it's going to be falling down around us. So it's part of a series of developments that are taking place across the region, and it was the Ulster's time. In terms of mental health, I couldn't agree more. I think lots of governments, I think I'd probably go back to Tony Blair's governments first off, promising that mental health was going to be treated in an equitable way to physical health. And I suppose, to be quite honest, lots of talk and not enough action has followed through. Now, there's been some fantastic work in mental health that's been done from people on the ground delivering the service, which has transformed people's lives. And I think the real success stories are, you know, in this very campus, where 30, 40, 50 years ago, there would have been 1,200 inpatients with mental health conditions, and we're now down to tens of beds on this site, and the vast majority of our mental health patients are actually in the community, clients receiving their home and support in a fantastic way, and on the road to recovery rather than being institutionalised and not having an opportunity to really maximise their lives. So I couldn't agree more on the mental health front. It's a big priority in the Minister's vision. We really need an executive back to start making decisions about how we're going to invest the various slices of the pie. But I'll be quite honest with you, our executive will be challenged because the pie is not big enough. It really is not big enough. And I really appreciate your research and your insight into how the NHS performs. It was the Commonwealth Fund. It was a work by the Commonwealth Fund which compared 11 countries. NHS, top of the pie. USA, funny enough, which spends twice the amount that we do on healthcare, was number 11 out of 11. And France, Sweden, Germany, 6, 7, 8, they were well down the line. So we actually do get an awful lot of value for money out of our services. But the reality is, as taxpayers, we pay either 20%, 40%, or 50-plus percent. And it's not creating sufficient income to actually meet the growing needs of our population. And I think there's a societal debate that needs to take place. What are we prepared to pay for first-class public services? If you're in Sweden, and bear in mind Sweden came sixth or seventh, you're paying 35% tax for your public services, and now they've got to the point where they realise that's not enough anymore. So this is a difficult one, and it's very much one that has to be influenced at a political level and right through to Westminster. I watched the Secretary of State for Health, Jeremy Hunt, on yesterday morning, managing to evade this very issue. We need to put more money into mental health, but where is it coming from? Are we going to take it away from physical health, cancer patients, whatever, to support our very important mental health? So for me, there's a bigger societal debate about what we're prepared to pay for public services. MRI scanner, we will keep on working hard to bring as many services as we can to the Down Hospital. You've heard me say this before. It's a fact. It sometimes annoys people when I say it, but actually there are more patients going through the Down Hospital today than have ever gone through that hospital. And I'm not even talking about the patients who go to see their GPs. I'm just talking about secondary care. Lots more outpatients, lots more diagnostics, lots more day surgery. Yes, we have fewer inpatient admissions. Believe it or not, the ED and combined nurse-led minor injury service, there are now as many people going through that service every year as there were before we made the first changes in 2011. So it is quite remarkable how we can still deliver lots of the services we need to, whilst recognising for better outcomes, some patients are more appropriate to go elsewhere. So there's lots of good stuff. Just very simply on the capital revenue issue, capital is a one-off amount of money. You get it once, you spend it. We need recurrent revenue to deliver more and more services locally in the Down. So you might need several million every year as opposed to a significant injection of capital cash, which is a separate budget. And as for repatriation, we actually repatriate our patients from the Down Patrick area, generally very well, from the Ulster back to the Down. It would be rare that people are kept in the Ulster for longer than they should be. It happens sometimes, absolutely. But by and large, that works really well. And there's a very close relationship between the Down and the Ulster. And sometimes I think it gets lost. The Ulster Hospital is the major acute hospital for many people in the greater Down Patrick area. People go there to have their babies in bigger numbers. They go there for their paediatric care. They will go there for specialist care. And they will go there for a range of services. So we need a really good Ulster Hospital for Down Patrick, as well as a good Down Hospital. And just final comment on that. I get the frustration that Councillor Andrews has raised around doctors. There's so many issues around this. But one, it's a buyer's market. Doctors will go wherever they want because there's a shortage of them. But primarily, doctors will go to a hospital where the work that they can do actually helps them to keep the skills that they've learned over sometimes 15 years to be a specialist in a particular area. So they need exposure to a range of conditions that helps them keep their skills. Now, what do we do about that? Well, okay, so doctors will choose where they want to work. It's a very competitive market. Francis wants the same doctor that I do. You know, we have all those challenges. But what we try to do in the Ulster Hospital is, as we've developed as a South Eastern Trust over the past 10 years, we have advertised jobs at consultant level primarily, whereby your job plan says, what's maybe 3/4 of your job is going to be in the Ulster Hospital, 1/4 of it's going to be in the Down Hospital or Leven Valley Hospital, with the net effect that 39 consultants who work from the Ulster Hospital also do sessions in the Down. So sometimes I think that's not widely known out there. So, for example, we have 17 consultants in emergency medicine. 4 of them do other duties, which means they're not able to actually take sessions in the Down or Leven Valley. But the other 13 will work a full day in either the Down or Leven Valley to try and maintain our emergency departments as best we can. So that may be going on a bit long, and I'll maybe move on to Shane.
Thanks very much, Chair. Francis, you want to take maybe some of Councillor Riley's points about first responders and GPs? Cover.
Okay, I can maybe I'll pass over just to see the first responders, but then I'll take the other issues, Chair, if that's okay. Thanks.
In terms of community first responders, they are fabulous and we need more of them. We have just appointed a lead for what's called a community resuscitation strategy. So it's an individual who's a very, very senior, actually paramedic and nurse. We've just appointed a small team, be 4 people, one to look after the north, south, east and west of Northern Ireland, and their job would be go out, find communities who want to become involved in first responding and develop first responders across Northern Ireland. They are a fabulous model. The idea that local communities can be trained to deal with first response. I mean, we all know in terms of CPR, you know, the idea of quick access to CPR is fundamentally important, and therefore it may have been the case in the past that NIAS were not promoting community first responders as much. As Chief Executive, it's a fundamental part of my strategy because they have been proven their worth. And unfortunately, I mean, the comment about the fire service as well, unfortunately the fire service pilot in Lurgan is no longer happening, because the fire brigade union have unfortunately walked away from it. But that is that's another really important part. I mean, I think it would be really important to begin to replicate that kind of pilot where the fire officers were getting to the patients often quicker than we were getting and often starting CPR. That's really where we've got to be. We've got to get other people starting CPR. We will still be there. We'll go to every call and we will, of course, do everything professionally to give that person the best chance of life. But the best chance of life starts with quick CPR, and therefore absolutely supporting community first responders.
Thank you, Shane. Councillor Riley, I'm just going to ask Geraldine to explain some of the initiatives and even the trust in terms of first responders, because we do recognise that that's an area we need to continue to build on.
Within the children's services, we would have quite a lot of young people who maybe have allergies, such as peanut allergy, etc., or we have children who are diabetic or children who are epileptic. And what we would do is work very closely with teachers in schools, and we would train the teachers in order to respond if a child became unwell during class. And our teachers have been really supportive and worked with us you know, to be able to give things like the EpiPen and be able to give things like buccal midazolam, etc., which is the first response to some of those conditions. The other people that work very closely with us as well are people in leisure services, which is, you know, your own staff, and in particular for summer schemes to support children with special needs, etc., that they'll work with us and we will train and support the leisure service staff in relation to the care of those children as well.
Thank you, Geraldine. Councillor Ray, just in response to a number of initiatives that you raised, leave role, respite is a particular difficulty for us for the reasons that Seamus explained. Our domiciliary care services, sorry, it was remiss of me to say, we have a 60-40% split, so 60% of our domiciliary care services are provided by the Trust. Nevertheless, it still does present us with an issue in terms of recruitment. And we depend on a lot of those people to provide respite care. So in spite of our very best efforts at this point, we haven't got the number of people that we require. But just as Seamus has explained, and hopefully I've done earlier, we're doing a lot more now to try and make those positions much more attractive. The other thing is that from a private sector provider now, most private sectors in the past also would have kept, we would have been able to buy, for instance, one or two respite beds from them. Now we can't do that because they keep their beds continually full. As I'm sure you appreciate, as a business, they need to do that. We would have been able to do that before. That's not available to us as much, unfortunately, now as it would have been in the past. But just hopefully that clarifies you. We did purposely keep the split 60-40, so the Trust always had the bigger percentage of Trust-employed domiciliary care services, and we will do our absolute best and utmost to try and recruit more people to that, given, as I've already said, there are some challenges around that. GP locums, unfortunately, are nothing to do with the Trust. We do not employ GPs, they're independent contractors, and therefore, whilst I do understand there are some issues, because I'm sure, Councillor Reilly, you're aware as well, GPs' positions are unfortunately becoming less attractive now, and there are some issues that the department are looking at in terms of the regional workforce, in terms of GPs. And for instance, you have seen in the national press last week that Jeremy Hunt offered GPs in England, and particularly in rural areas, another £20,000 a year to work in those practices. That is not something that which, you know, has been offered at this point in time here, but we have exactly the same issues, but unfortunately those are out with the control of the Trust. Community First Aid, I absolutely agree with you. There's lots more we need to do. We do some training around that. We do a lot of training around, in particular, with children, adolescents and adults around mental health first aid, and we've done an awful lot in the Trust around that, but we do need to do, if you like, general first aid training, and I would accept that, and I will certainly take that back to the teams that currently do that within the Trust. Were there any other issues, Councillor Ray? Those are the three that I had.
Yes, more or less I covered that.
Yes.
Thanks very much.
I was more sort of concerned about an assurance on the long-term future of Sleaver
at the moment. There are no plans for us to do anything with Sleaver at this point. At one stage, you know, that a couple of years ago now, not only within our Trust, but there was perhaps a move to look at some of those facilities. That is certainly not part of any of our efficiency plans at this point in time.
That's very reassuring.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for your cooperation. Now, the next group of councillors are Councillor Kimmins first.
Okay, thanks, Chair, and thanks to all the previous speakers. It's quite a lot of positive things coming out there as well. And just a few questions. Both on a professional and a personal level, I would have a particular interest in the older people's issues. I work in care management myself, so I'm quite aware of a lot of the challenges that are faced both in the domiciliary sector and in terms of nursing care and hospitals. It's very good to hear that there's a big recruitment drive happening. In terms of making recruitment more attractive, is pay one of those things that will be looked at? Because I think from dealing with both Trust staff and private providers, you know, we find that private providers particularly would say, you know, more and more tasks are being asked of care staff who are out in the community, and are we making that attractive for the providers to take on, you know, in terms of the hourly rate, etc. I know that there is the annual uplift, and hopefully that will start to reflect the greater amount of work that is involved in domiciliary care. And sort of alluding to the points made by Councillor Andrews and Councillor Reddy in terms of respite care, there are different perspectives on how it's delivered in Southern Trust and South Eastern Trust. In Southern Trust, I think there's 8 weeks per year is offered in South Eastern that's financially assessed. You know, is there scope there where, you know, in terms of supporting carers, where there's maybe, I'm thinking along the lines of self-directed support, where there's a temporary budget even allocated where a respite bed isn't available, that someone could have 24-hour care at home for a week or 2 weeks to try and take the pressure off. And obviously that would help with carers, and also if people are in hospital or things like that, I need extra support to discharge. Dementia, I think, as you said, Francis, is growing. It's particularly huge in this area. And one of the things that I find, even in personal experience, is the lack of dementia awareness, maybe among hospital staff, the lack of time people have to deal with patients who have dementia, particularly for feeding and things like that. You know, witness myself where, and I know staff are really under pressure, but where they're maybe not, don't have the time to feed someone with dementia who can't feed themselves. So, you know, they're challenging, but, you know, how do we address that? Is there scope for recruiting more domiciliary staff within hospitals, or, you know, auxiliary staff and things like that within hospitals that would be able to address those things? Because as you said yourself, you know, people are going into hospital and coming out with more things than they had when they went in. So, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it would have a huge benefit. And the last one, I suppose, around top-ups is something I face on a daily basis myself, and I know it's right across the board. In terms of third-party regulations, it's maybe a government issue, but along the CRAD guidelines where it has to be a third party pay a top up, it does create serious barriers for people who need access to 24-hour care in placement, whether it's nursing or residential. Statutory provision isn't there in terms of placement, and they are maybe in a crisis situation. So is there any scope for us to look at that and look at other options in terms of top up to make sure that everyone's needs are able to be met within the remit?
Thanks,
Councillor Cummins. Councillor Moore? Yeah, folks, thanks for coming tonight, and it's been very interesting listening to all the enough, and thanks for taking all the questions. My question is primarily for Shane. Shane, the area that I represent and the area I live in is in South Armagh, and there's been historically frustration and at times verging on anger at the length of time it takes an ambulance and the time. There's a lot of respect for the job that ambulance drivers do and the ambulance service provide. But you talked about historically an 8-minute target. I don't think Lewis Hamilton will be able to get to South Armagh, to get to Dorsey or to Newtown or to Cullaville in 8 minutes from Newry, and especially not from Craigavon. Just in the last few years, I lost my mother in 2013. She waited 44 minutes on an ambulance in Newtown Hamilton. There's no ambulance available in Newry, so it came from Craigavon. In 2016, my next door neighbour's child took epilepsy for the first time, and they waited for 72 minutes. They complained, they made a subsequent complaint to the ambulance service. There was some, the ambulance had been sent out and taken away again, or there was some confusion over to that there. But not 2 weeks ago, there was a person collapsed outside the hotel in Crossing Glen, and they waited almost an hour. Now, we were alluding to and referring to a possible collaborative approach with the fire and rescue service. There was a fireman in the hotel in Cross who came out and was able to keep the woman alive until an ambulance arrived. And I spoke with some of the firemen about Cross, and they were keen, and they saw that it was probably part of their remit and their responsibility as trained first aiders to provide that service for the community. And when I told them about this meeting tonight, they had said, you know, if it was up to them, they'd be willing to provide it. There's a first responders group in Crossing Glen and the Crossing Glen, wider Crossing Glen area as well, which are providing first class service as well. So I think from the point of view of people living in South Armagh, it's very easy to throw stones and shout and argue that an ambulance can't get there fast enough. I don't think an ambulance will ever be able to get there fast enough. So in that reality, it would be a collaborative approach with the fire rescue and first responders, or perhaps exploring a cross-border approach. I know that on occasion ambulances from the south will take patients to Daisy Hill Hospital, and could it be a thing that the closest ambulance to South Armagh could actually be somewhere about Dundalk or that, and it could, you know, it might get there quicker.
Yeah, that's it. Okay, thanks, Councillor. Councillor Byrne.
Yeah, in the interest of time, I'll not keep it too long, because exactly what Councillor Murray had said is the point I was going to come in on. The frustration from Cross Midland, so that's my area in South Armagh as well, and I'm not going to go over everything that Barrett said, but it's completely, you know, the frustration of the people that speak to me as well. The first responder scheme that's set up there, and there's pressures over the last year, it is a successful scheme and it's volunteers within it, but with that responsibility comes pressure. And I know even a case of a neighbour of mine, his father passed away 6 months ago due to the wrong warden that triggered the first responders, caused, you know, serious pain on the volunteers that were in the area because people were only 100 yards away from them. And we had defibs there on the walls, but it's just getting the people out. You talk about times of ambulances going to South Armagh, and Barrow is completely right. You say 30% of the calls are Category A, but actually, I think the figures you said was actually 7% of them are Category A calls. And if we did sort of weed out the real calls that are Category A, then that's the reason why ambulances aren't getting to the other Category A calls. That is correct in a sense, but it's not the reason why ambulances aren't getting to South Armagh. Ambulances aren't getting to South Armagh because the date to start off from is too far away. So yes, a scheme with the fire service or a cross-border scheme would absolutely be the way to go, but it's the hub of where the ambulance is leaving. And if we're talking about, and I completely agree with the points that I made about keeping people out of hospital, I lost both grandparents last year, and one of them was, when he went into hospital, would rather have stayed in his house, you know, to get the treatment, the critical care. So I suppose Newry and Armagh is the only area that doesn't have critical care at home at the minute, and I'll take a positive from the comments that were said there that we hope by February or January, February 2018 that we will have this in place. And I think, you know, it's a move in the right direction of keeping people out of hospital. We talk about domiciliary care, and people say to me all the time, 15 minutes in and out, you know, to get treated is not enough. But I understand the pressures in the service as well. And, you know, from another, unfortunately, another family member that was in hospital last year had to stay in for, I think it was 9 days, to rebuild a care package to get them sent home. So I understand the frustrations around that, and the way forward is keeping people out of hospital. But if we are doing that and there's critical care at home, then the first thing we need to do is make sure that the ambulance service is on a par right across the district. Before keeping people in their houses, we need to make sure that in an emergency situation that we can get an ambulance to them people that aren't going to be in hospital in the future. So I'd like, you know, from Shane, maybe you look at, yes, rolling out with the first responders and the fire service like in Logan, but hubs that are, you know, strategically placed across the district, that the rural areas aren't, you know, less more disadvantaged than the urban areas.
Okay, thanks, Pete. Do you want to deal with first then yourself, Shane?
Certainly. Thank you both for the questions. I'll deal with the in slightly reverse order. Cross border, we have been working with National Ambulance Service to look at a new memorandum of understanding for cross border. Although we've had a slight spanner in the works heading towards Brexit, but we can try and work through that. So we're about to sign off on a new memorandum of understanding between the two of us, and therefore it will be in cross-border areas regularly. The nearest ambulance will be the first responder. Okay, so that's pieces of work that we know. We do a lot of that the other way around in the northwest of the province, where in many cases we're the first responder. NIAS is the first responder in Buncrana, or the first responder sometimes in other towns in Donegal. There's no reason why we can't work, and we are working with them to try and explore that. That will not solve all the problems across the Glen, but I think it's an important element to it. Community first responders, absolutely. But I will commit to go away and exploring what we need to do about geography. We're working with this organisation's company at the moment to look at where should our ambulance stations be, and we're looking at where our demand is versus where our ambulances are. I say it's the same company that's done the other work for us and worked with other ambulance services, particularly in Wales, because Powys in the middle of Wales is not dissimilar to a lot of our areas in terms of exceptionally rural. So we are actively looking at where should we have deployment points, and the numbers will take us to that answer. In other words, can we, should we change the number of our deployment points to meet where demand is? So we're actively looking at that, and I am more than happy to come back to you directly or through this forum once we finish that piece of work. Because we, the point you make is correct. If we get the 30% to the 7%, it gives us a greater chance of ambulances being available, but they have to be close and available. And the point you make is correct. So we are looking into that. I don't have an answer for you at the moment, but absolute commitment. I will come back when we begin to explore that further.
Okay, thanks. Councillor Kilman's questions. You want to take up on?
Yes. So I think there were about four, Councillor Kilman, if I remember them, I've written them down properly. But the first one being domiciliary care pay. And as you know, obviously, with a background in care management, there's a regional contract and regional rate set for that. However, there is a complete new regional workforce strategy that covers every person from right through to doctors, nurses, AHP, support staff. What we as chief executives and directors have said is that the social care workforce, which obviously includes domiciliary care, needs to be significantly overhauled and looked at. And I think it would be fair to say, with the inference that something needs to be done about their career progression, their pay. You know already that the terms have better terms and conditions than of some of the other private providers that the trust have. But that still doesn't seem to be enough to attract people, and it is a very responsible and indeed a much more complex job than perhaps it would have been. So I would like to say to you that it's within our gift to change that, but I think you know that it isn't. But it's not to say that those representations haven't been made regionally, and hopefully that will change at some stage in the not too distant future. In relation to, you know, support for discharge and respite, I do recognise that the Southern Trust have a different arrangement in terms of charging, etc. I suppose what we are trying to do, not only between the two trusts, is to get the region to agree that everybody does the same thing. So that would seem sensible to me. It's not really fair that in one trust you don't get charged and you get maybe 8 weeks free, and another trust you do. Gets back to the point that Councillor Andrews was making earlier about people who need to pay for those sorts of things. So we do recognise that, and we've made those representations also, because that's a disparity that clearly isn't acceptable. What we're doing in recognition of that in the trust is that we have two new schemes, actually. They're called Support to Discharge. One has been operating for a year, and the other one we're just about to introduce, which is two of our residential care homes offering that sort of support to people who require it. That is about sort of focusing on rehab for maybe a period of 8 to 10, tests probably around a maximum of 12 weeks, with input from a rehab team or AHP. So we're doing that with six beds in each of the residential homes on both sides of the trust. So it means that actually Murraymore's side is covered and the Armagh and Gannon side is covered. And that's something that we're trying to do to alleviate that situation, because you also will know that self-directed support, which for the benefit of other people, if you excuse me within the room that maybe don't know what that means, we would give people money if they want to buy that service themselves. And, you know, we would do that actually because of the logistics around all of that. It's not our logistics, it's government logistics around tax and employment and redundancy. Most people say to us, do you know what, Francis, I couldn't be bothered with that. So that's we do offer that. And Seamus, they offer that as well. You know yourself, Councillor, most people don't want that. In relation to the dementia services, we have within the trust, we have reviewed the entirety of our dementia services within the trust. And alongside that, what we have done is rolled out a programme across all of our hospital services that actually has educated all of our nursing and support and allied health professionals and medical staff to deal with people who have dementia, because unfortunately our hospitals are full of people with physical illnesses but who also have dementia. So that's what we're doing, and it has been of significant help. because a lot of our staff, through no fault of their own, didn't know how to deal with people with dementia. And the other thing that we've done, but we still have some work to do, I think it's fair to say, is that we've greatly increased the number of volunteers we have in hospital settings. So we do now encourage families to come in to help to feed the relatives, and we don't put any restrictions on that. And we do encourage volunteers to come in. But again, we've more work to do there, but we have made some progress. So it's just, you know, to let you know that those sort of things are happening. And then top-ups, well, you know, this has been an issue since ever I worked in care management many, many years ago, more years than I care to remember. Unfortunately, this is an issue which, you know, is again not set by the trust. It's to do with the CRAG, the charging documentation and legislation. The top-ups, as you know, are set by the home. And the third-party element of it, we have made those representations to say that makes it significantly difficult, more difficult for people. And again, excuse me if I'm teaching the granny how to suck eggs, but just for other people, that means that if I can't go into a home and say I'm going to pay another £40 a week, someone has to do that for me. That's what they call a third party, and that causes a lot of difficulty. That's what Councillor Kimmins is referring to, and we've also made those representations. But that then, as you know, has gone off down a whole legal route, because people then say, could someone be abused or whatever if that wasn't the case. So just to say, we have, all of the trusts have actually brought those to the attention of the board and the department, but a lot of it is enshrined in legislation, as you know, Councillor, but we are trying to do our level best to try and make it, because it would make it much easier for us as a trust as well. Is there anything else? Does that have a cover? No? Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks for that. We'll take the next group then, Councillor Savage.
Firstly, I'd like to welcome the group here tonight, and to have heard such positive input from yourselves and engagement with ourselves. I think we all get sort of some sort of a sense of the challenge you face on a day-to-day basis with the huge financial pressures that the system's under at the moment. I'm going to refer to, it's late in the day, so refer to the last sort of issue that we raised, and that's in relation to the concerns in relation to the ongoing future of Daisy Hill. As an area councillor, it's an issue that very much rings in my ears on a daily basis, as you can understand. But I'm looking at terms like the pie's not big enough, and there are growing needs there. And at the stroke services review consultation that we had, I raised this issue with Dr. Farrell at the time. And that was, again, tapping into some of the issues that were raised in relation to the ambulance service, in relation to cross-border. Geography is in relation to where we are as a border town, and our proximity much closer to Dundalk, effectively, than where we are nearly to Craigavon. When we did raise the issue in relation to what sort of moves have been taking place between the HSC and the NHS, the trust here, and our counterparts in North Louth and Monaghan, I was told that, you know, there were discussions hopefully going to take place, and we got the sense that those discussions were very much embryonic, and that concerned me a bit in that I felt that, you know, the geography of where we are and the opportunities that are there to not only bring services to Daisy Hill, but to bring consultants because of an increased patient turnover, etc., in that hospital. If we were able to attract more patients from the North Louth and County Monaghan area on a cross-border basis with stronger levels of cooperation, the question effectively is that what steps have been taken? I know with the backdrop of Brexit, but now, but what steps have been taken to try and enhance those relationships on a cross-border basis to provide services that would effectively lead to the safeguarding of the future of Daisy Hill? Another issue I would raise would be, I was led to believe this week that we ran into huge pressures in A&E in Uri with patients being diverted to Craigavon. So, you know, I would look at all the pointers, given the young population we have and the huge increase that we're having with our elderly population in Uri as a city, that we want to safeguard the future of our local hospital. And obviously the cognizance of the challenges that you face as a health service and trying to have specific specialist treatments in certain hospitals. But the big concern that I would have would be that we're maybe going at this a bit late in the day. Has there been enough done over the years working with the HSC in the south? I know there's big concerns talking to counterparts in Dundalk that they believe there's huge missed opportunities been there over the years in relation to having enhanced cross-border cooperation with Daisy Hill for the people of Dundalk and County Monaghan.
My question is basically, is that part of the strategy going forward, and what work is still to be scoped out on that, and what's been done to date? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Councillor Savage. Councillor McAteer.
Okay, and I'm sure you're probably drawn weary at this stage, but anyway, well done. Thanks for coming along. I just think, first of all, maybe going forward, I know you hadn't much warning, I suppose, of the questions that I asked you when you received, I think, the letter of the 19th, but it probably would be helpful if we had the full answers, you know, to the questions in advance in writing, so that we can fully peruse the details, so as to touch you even more in a sense. But forgive me for that, but I think maybe that's going forward a good way to do it. Second item I have really is impression on about the waiting lists in facilities voted Solomon Trust. I mean, you read some of the statistics, certainly, you know, you can't fault for the people out there have become quite demoralised in a sense when, you know, when some of the people are facing certain disciplines up to 3 years, they've been told they have to wait for maybe outpatient treatment. But yet again, what really then annoys them altogether is that they can find out they can get an appointment next week privately. You know, and there's people trying to marry this together. You know, how can somebody at the end of the day have to wait for 2 or 3 years, but yet again they get an appointment next week? You know, so that doesn't stand up well in terms of how our community is going forward with health and healthcare. You know, there's a kind of a dichotomy there that needs addressed. But again, just looking at some of the figures produced on the waiting list, you know, I'm very disturbed to find that in our southern area here in the last 3 months, the ministerial target for urgent GP referral for breast cancer births, it was 100%, but in our area here, it was about an average in the last 3 months, only 21%, compared to Western and the Northern and the Belfast Trust areas, where it was up in 100%. In fact, Western was 100%. So maybe you could explain those statistics, but it's certainly very worrying to me, I'm sure, to people out there who've been referred urgently. So, generally speaking, and I know there's been work going on in terms of trying to reduce the waiting list, but you have to appreciate, and I know it's difficult, but it's certainly a community, as I use the word demoralised, the community are totally demoralised by this, and they're facing such a long time. I know people who have arthritis and living in pain, waiting on referrals, waiting on operations, you know, and that's what I'm only reflecting what's out there in the community. All the question I had again is the new community treatment hub in Uri. Could you give me any update on how that's progressing? Because it seems to have totally and utterly stalled. And I know that was going to be, you know, it was going to bring a lot of services together, and maybe some, I was told, that could be added to it that may alleviate some of the problems in Daisy Hill and the site itself in Daisy Hill, how constricted it is in terms of offering patient space and care. So maybe you get some information on that. So thank you.
Okay, thanks, Councillor McAteer. Councillor Corn.
Oh, thanks, Chair. I think most of my questions have been already answered, but there's a few things which is maybe like some enlightenment on. And I've seen the rescue. We've already heard about this service in the rural areas being in the long time now, waiting thing we got there. The other thing was the turnaround time in the Rundal. And Seamus, I think, has already answered that earlier on, so we have to get there. But Seamus, just when would you see some, you know, results there coming there, so that this maybe could be relieved, and so the ambulance would be out there in the rural areas that we need them out there, excuse me. Can I ask you, Seamus, was there a recruitment drive there not so long ago in getting people for the ambulance service? Because there was one particular time when you did make a presentation, not yourself here, but made a presentation here, and there's a great dilemma as far as backup staff there was there when people took off sick, and if there was a recruitment drive, how successful was it? Thank you very much, Chair.
Okay, thanks, Councillor Corn. I suppose we'll start off with Councillor Savage's question was in around Jason Hill and an all Ireland type service.
Yes, Chair. And then I'll ask Aldrina to take the one about the Community Care and Treatment Centre, because she's very much involved in that. Daisy Hill Hospital, you know, Councillor Savage, has been a number of issues over this past while, particularly this past couple of years, and those have been primarily around workforce issues. And we have been out, as you know, and probably have seen in local and national presses for advertisements at least half a dozen times for senior medical staff. However, the Pathfinder project has now, with a needs assessment of the whole area, and you have just very eloquently stated how busy we were last week and actually this week. Today, even looking at the figures today, Daisy Hill is still under significant pressure. It's a very busy hospital, and so is Craigavon. So between the two of them, we're trying to manage that. So what we are now embarking on with the community and in the spread of co-production is to looking at a way in which we can make a model work across the acute hospital sites, which means that Daisy Hill may look differently in the future in terms of the sites that it offers, the services that it offers, but that gets back to the point that Seamus was making earlier. What we're trying to do now is create a service that is more attractive for staff to come and work in, and that's primarily senior nurses and doctors, because what they're saying to me is we need a different sort of service to enable us to keep our skills and competency that we've trained for whatever. So we're prepared to do that. The Pathfinder project has cited that, and there are a number of issues that they talk about in terms of ambulatory care, frail elderly services, discharge, early discharge, all of those new services that will be brought to the hospital. That is assuming we can get the workforce, and they've been honest to say that you're not going to get that in 6 or 9 or 12 months. It will take probably a few years for us to reach the full potential there. But part of the equation is also working with the South of Ireland because we are so near to it. Now, we do that, and actually Geraldine could talk to you about some of our children's services and ENT services and some of the other services that we're now embarking on, particularly in the Nurium and Mourne area around older people services, which is cross-border working. Now, we need to maximise more on that, and there are some other national services that I would suggest we could probably be linked into as well. So there is a recognition through the Pathfinder project that that is the way forward. We did, even before the Pathfinder project, the Department of Health and the HSC did have their HSC up to meet with us, and they are willing to look at that. To be fair, they've only got to the stage because they've been going through, as you know, a huge reform in the site where they can look at it now. So I have to be honest and say to you, yes, that is part of the equation. We have done some bits, and actually some very successful bits, and look, we're happy for you to come and talk to us about all of those, and we'll explain those in great detail to you. But that is part of the way forward and part of the way that we need to work to ensure the safety of patients and the future of Daisy Hill Hospital and indeed acute hospital services. But I will say, please come and talk to us. We will explain all of that to you in more detail than I could tonight. The other thing, I think just moving in to Councillor McTeer about waiting lists, and kind of first of all deal with our breast services. That is a regrettable position that we are in. We probably, you are aware, for a number of years we're at 100% in terms of reaching our targets. Unfortunately, two of our consultants died within 4 weeks of one another, and we have 7 vacancies in terms of our consultant radiologists. So with the best will in the world, we do not have the workforce to actually meet those targets. However, we now work with the Northern Trust, Southeastern Trust. Seamus, as Director of Hospital Services and Acute, has helped us very significantly, and that's to ensure that those women who need to be seen are seen, and those two trusts, and indeed the West, are helping us also. It's not ideal, however, the safety of those women is our priority, and we have to send them elsewhere. So I just want to be clear, it's not that those women aren't seen and there's no service. We just have to ask them to go somewhere else for the initial screening, and then we take them back to do all the treatment. And in the future, obviously, we will be looking at, and again, this is something that we do need to consider regionally, what is the best way to provide our breast services and other specialty services, because the fact of the matter is we simply do not have enough doctors and nurses to run that service in 5 trusts, and we owe it to the population, you know, the women in our society, to be able to provide that service when they need it. So we are looking at that, but I just want to be clear and say all of those women, particularly those women who we term as red flag, which means you have potentially, yes, we see all those women, but they might have to travel to Southeastern Trust or the Northern Trust to be seen. That's a regrettable situation, but it was unavoidable because of the circumstances that I have described. So it's not an efficiency. I just want to be clear about that. And then the other issue again around waiting lists is that yes, there is, and indeed across all the trusts, a number of areas where there are waiting lists, and that's not always simply a matter of not having the money to provide that service. At this point in time, it is primarily a matter of not having the workforce to provide the service. So again, that's why the region now have their brand new regional workforce strategy, which will be out with us in another week or so, and then we will be going to look at how we can attract doctors and nurses, and not only to come and work in Northern Ireland, but to work in different ways, such as Seamus and I have described. So for instance, getting back to Daisy Hill Hospital, we've gone out to advertise for consultants in the ED department, and what we said to them, if you come and work for us, you can go and work a day a week in the Royal or in South Eastern Trust or in somewhere else in a specialty that keeps your skills up to date, and that then makes it more attractive for them. So it's trying to be very creative about all those things, and I hope that goes some way to explain. The only thing I would say, Councillor, if there are particular areas that you are concerned about, I'm very happy to talk to you about that with my senior staff as well, if there are areas or people waiting in an ordinance amount of time for an appointment.
Okay, thanks, sir.
Just, Chairman, maybe to pick up on the community treatment centre, position of the community treatment centre, just to, I'm probably in a better position to advise on it. We have received a transport plan at the start of last week from the developer or the developer of the community treatment centre. It will be analysed, and again, I have talked to our planners with the intention of early in the new year getting the proposals put before the planners for the, as you will know, there's a decision made on outline planning, but on the delegated matters will be coming before the council planning committee early in the new year.
Yeah, if I could pick up Councillor Kearns' queries, just to reiterate that we're working very closely with the ambulance service, and we're expecting to have a second hospital ambulance liaison officer into the Ulster Hospital, which will then give us a 7-day coverage. That post is really critical in helping in terms of the ambulance diverts, for example, on occasions, and the handover times. We are planning to commence an interim scheme just ahead of the worst of the winter in January. Now, it'll not be a fully fledged dedicated area, dedicated staff. There will be an assigned area, and there will be staff who will be assigned as part of their job to make sure that they get those handovers swiftly. So that's something we will have in place ahead of January. The one thing I have to say is, winter is coming. It sounds like the Game of Thrones. But this winter, I think the entire system is struggling from a staffing point of view. And a lot of the things that we would have had in place last winter, or maybe the winter before, we're struggling to get staffing, particularly nursing staff, quite frankly. So we're really having to be quite innovative about doing other things. And some of those things, Francis has already touched on in terms of the ambulatory management. So we're managing more intense and professional staff around the patient to try and keep them at home. They might come up to hospital, but more work done with them. They might be with us for 8 or 10 hours, and then we can safely get them home as opposed to the default position of admission. And for example, a lot of the work we've been doing in the Ulster this year has been around focusing on ambulatory management. So we've had ambulatory emergency medicine in the ED for many years. Acute medicine have been doing that. Respiratory medicine has particularly kicked off from before the summer. They were doing 3 days a week just yesterday, or today, sorry. They started 5 days a week. And we have some stroke work that we're doing ambulatory management in as well. Now, all of this has actually meant that for the first time, and only the second time in my 21 years career as a director, we've actually admitted fewer patients in the first 6 months of this year compared to the same period last year, when we would have expected another 400 or 500 emergency admissions. Now, it's 93 patients less. But it's a sign to me that we could have been admitting 400 or 500, and we've actually 93 less. So some of those ambulatory approaches are really delivering huge benefits. The biggest problem for us is we're still dealing with that 5-year exponential growth, and we're playing catch up all the time. So I do worry about the winter, to be quite frank with you, about what we're going into. The only other comment I wanted to make was just a general one, and I think the more questions you ask us, the more I keep coming back to health and well-being, disease prevention. How can we really make a difference in the future? Now, it's not going to be a difference overnight, sadly, but actually, if we're really thinking in the long term, this upstream work is becoming even more important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Alvina, you want to pick a couple of points up?
Just a few more. To add to Councillor Savage's queries in relation to AV Health, it was really probably more just for an awareness for members, just to say if people haven't noticed, but if you go onto the Trust website, we are keeping monthly updates on the Daisy Hill Pathfinder project, and I just wanted to highlight that for council members because it's a good way to keep abreast of what's happening in those discussions, which as Francis alluded to is very much a co-production, co-design with the local community. The other thing I wanted to highlight in relation to that, anybody who's been following the Daisy Hill issue, which I'm sure you all have been, over recent months, that our recruitment has been a major issue. We are currently out to recruit again for a consultant, but I was trying to pick up really on a point Seamus made earlier, the job descriptions that we're describing to hopefully recruit to a consultant post, which is being recruited to interviews for the 20th of November, is to have posts that are linked with other centres, because the reality is in terms of the workforce, they want to be cohorted with other specialties, be it either trauma in Belfast and or through wider services within Craigavon. So that job description will describe that, and getting an applicant, they will get some flexibility in terms of deciding what that model looks like, and we'll be prepared to negotiate with Belfast or wherever else to make that happen. So that's really just for awareness. The other thing to mention was in terms of some of our work with the cooperation working together, otherwise known as COT, and we have a history of working with Cross Border through the COT scheme. And we are looking at, as part of this, two areas really that are linked in the Daisy Hill. One is it's at early days in with Interreg 5 funding, but it's in relation to dermatology. And the other one is in relation to what is clinical decision unit, essentially based in Daisy Hill. So we haven't worked through the details of that, but we've got support on a cross-border basis with the HSC to help develop that. So it was just an add to those points.
Thanks very much. Shane or Geraldine?
The question about recruitment, the ambulance service. We had funding for 72 more what are called EMTs. So they're the two levels. We've got a paramedic, who is the senior, and then you have the EMT who supports them. 72, we appointed all 72. We actually had 1,800 applicants, which is quite astounding, because it doesn't require a clinical background. We train people from the beginning to the end. So we had 72 join us. We've managed to get through two cohorts of 24 with a third cohort still to get through training. So 48 of those are now on the road. We would love to do more of that, and that's part of our growth plans. Clearly, we would love to get more in, because the more resource you can have, obviously you can put more people out. But yes, fully filled, all 72, and 48 of them are now working on the ground. That really is.
The other point that was being made there in relation to cross-border work is that one of the big things that we're doing in Daisy Hill, as probably everybody is aware, is we're developing children's ward on the top floor, and it's a huge project which will be finished, and we should be starting our first surgery in January. And incorporated in that is a short stay unit, which is, to try and take some of the pressure off ED, but it's also the parents do not want the children in hospital overnight if it can be avoided. So this is an opportunity where kids can come in, be seen, assessed, treated, and turned around back home again. But the biggest thing is the theatre that's going to be up there. It'll be a dedicated children's theatre, and we've already had some discussions, to look at cross-border work around, for example, ENT surgery, which, it's highly probable that we'll be able to do some work around that.
Okay, thanks, Jerry. Councillor, back to you. Welcome back.
Of the women then offered an appointment elsewhere? Are they actually offered that or refused that?
No, they're offered it.
They're offered it but haven't taken it up?
Anybody who would refuse, as far as we're aware.
I'm just trying to figure out why, I saw a bit of a rise from 6.7% in 2016, and presumed the intervention that you spoke of, which started usually all the trusts kicked in, brought it up to 19%.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, were they people offered it and didn't, you know, why then is it, you know, some of the trusts are on at 100%, you'd think you'd be able to slot it in under the 14 days, but that's why I'm asking the question.
Just a
quick comment before you go to that. Quick comment. I do admire your talking about your new workforce strategy.
Yeah.
But I do think talking to people out there, employees on the ground, a lot of the issues is around maybe the former non-imaginative work practices and how you can fit in with people's lives and giving them job opportunities and career opportunities.
Yes.
That's where the whole new dimension is. So I'm glad to hear that.
Just before Aldrina finishes it, just to say, yes, it probably is possible for some people to get private appointments, not in the hospital. They can get them in 352 Lisburn Road, you know, in the private hospitals, because actually it contained within the consultant's contract is an opportunity for them to be able to do that. Mm-hmm. But they do not. A person cannot, if you want to put it crudely like this, jump an NHS list to get a private appointment.
Okay. Aldrina, you want to?
Yeah, just in relation to breast, we are in a situation where this time last year we were at 100%, but another trust fell over, and it was the Northern Trust. We've all had difficulties with regard to breast services, breast assessment services across the region, and the simple answer for that is it is a workforce issue. We are spread too thin. We are delivering the services across all five trust areas currently, and we're not able to do it with the workforce we have. So as whether it's the tragic circumstances of somebody dying, retiring, one member of staff leaves from our trust and goes to work in Southeastern for whatever reason or whatever, can be the difference between 100% and 14%, 17%, 7%. What we are doing, though, is working collectively with the other trusts and with the Health and Social Care Board on two fronts. Firstly, we are getting support from the other trusts for their staff to be able to take on some additional to help us ensure that our women are seen within 14 days. Some women generally pick up those appointments. Sometimes, if they're offered the West, believe it or not, they don't. But by and large, we've now at least got the participation of all trusts, so we are able to offer alternatives. What we are doing is also making it, because of that is a bit more complex to arrange, we're ensuring that the moment the referral comes in, those go off to the other trust, so there's not a wait with the Southern Trust before they move on in a bid to try to make the 14 days. What ultimately will happen is that each trust trying to maintain their 14 days, if there's a system, we had a different, whatever the number is, days. At the moment, just to be clear, so we were saying when we were in a poor position where people were waiting in excess of, you know, well beyond the 14 days. What we're trying to do is get the system to where if we're sitting with waits, it's not more than 21 days is ultimately where we're trying to get to. And lastly, the work with the Health and Social Care Board then is to look at this model. In our trust, for example, we are reliant on one single-handed breast radiologist, and that's a very specialist skill. And if that person's off for a week, it's a 14-day target. They go on their holidays, we get 7%, not 100%. So that's the fragility of the service. So just to say that it is a system where we need to collaborate, and the Health and Social Care Board is trying to now look at, as part of the Bengal work, and it's installed somewhat, but they are still working through what is it that would be a sustainable service for all of Northern Ireland. And as Francis says, just to pick up, what we do have still is the surgical end of the services that are more robust. Therefore, people can go and have their assessment, have their diagnosis confirmed and or not, and then return to the Southern Trust for the rest of the treatment pathway.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Councillor Savage, you want to supplement it? Yes. Before? Sorry, Haya, you've been very patient.
Yeah, sorry, I'm not being on. Sure, just a comment on it. I do welcome the cross-border work and the engagement we've had tonight in relation to the information coming from there. It seems to be on a broader scale than the public are aware of. And certainly would like to chat with you again about those other opportunities down the line. Just on the issue of, obviously, we've all been looking for the silver bullet, pardon the pun, in relation to the problem in Daisy Hill in relation to the ED consultant. And I do welcome the move that's been made, because I think it's a wise one given the challenges, big challenges you've faced over the years in trying to recruit someone for that position, which is crucial to Daisy Hill as well as other specialities. Do you have sort of any evidence that this sort of form of recruitment as such has worked in other places across the globe, or are we sort of fumbling in the dark if it is evidence based, is it something that has proven to work before in attracting top consultants?
Sure. Yes, we do. We have evidence locally, not even internationally or elsewhere. Just it is about talking to the workforce and finding out what is it that makes a job more attractive. The bit that we haven't mentioned also, which is a key part particularly that we're working through with regard to the Daisy Hill plan, is new roles, new skills developed, in particular things that are now based in evidence that are working well in either America and or in England, is roles such as physician associates, which provide another tier in support. And what we do know from some of the evidence across the water there is that where those posts are in place, that becomes a more attractive consultant job because it provides a structure, if you will, a scaffolding around what the consultant job is. So that's proven. And the other one is in advanced nurse practitioners. Now, we have struggled in the past to get those, and it's a combination of training places, et cetera, and it's a longer-term game. But those are the things that we're actively working through to try to make the whole model. It's not just about the doctors, it's about the full skill mix more attractive for the Daisy Hill model.
Councillor Harvey.
Okay, thank you, Chair. Thank you all for your patience. Just a wee question for Seamus Francis. You made a comment that to say that if you had four more wards, that it wouldn't be the answer to the problems, that we really do need to be doing things differently. How long do you reckon it will take you to get things to an acceptable level that would be acceptable to you and to the community? And thank you. And just a comment too to the ambulance service to say that's great, great news about your fleet, that it's all 5 years in a year. Thank you.
Good morning, Councillor Holly.
We are already doing some of those things which has proven to be of benefit. So, for instance, the frail elderly service that I was talking about and Seamus was talking about, in the evaluation we did of that, what it proved was that 25% of the people who would normally be in hospital did not come into hospital as a result, and that's only one service. When I talked about ambulatory care, which is really about somebody coming in, having whatever their assessment done, their diagnosis, so if they need blood done, an x-ray or whatever, some of the hospitals we have looked at in England have an ambulatory care area the size of the entire first floor of Craigavon Hospital. So it just shows you how actually that can help. So those services, if you're talking about frail elderly services or talking about rapid assessment or chest clinics, if you think you put all those together, they do make a difference. The problem, to be honest, is the space to have that done, because particularly if you think about the like of Daisy Hill or Craigavon or indeed some of the other hospitals, they're old hospitals, and actually you need to actually, yeah. So that's part of the problem. So it would be unfair of me to say, oh, we could do it all in 3 months if I had. We wouldn't, because part of it is about workforce. It's about training people differently to do different things, having physician's assistants, having advanced nurse practitioners, but also either extending, converting, or building part of hospitals to enable us to do that. So realistically, you're probably, again, talking about, you know, a few years lead into that. That's not to say you can't do a number of different things separately and then collectively make a difference, but to get what we're talking about, to get to that position, would probably, in fairness, take at least, I would imagine, 2 to 3 years to do.
Yeah, I suppose I could go back to the reason why I'm choosing North Down and Ards is because I spent a longer part of my career there. Probably 25 years ago, there were 1,250 beds in the Ulster, Ards, Bangor and Crawfordsburn hospitals. Today, we've got less than half of that. And why is that? It's because we've been doing things differently for a very long time. We've had huge advances in medicine in terms of practice, doing things differently, be that ambulatory, be that operating on patients now as a day case where they might have been in for 5 days before. Average length of stay in our elderly wards might have been 4 weeks back then. Now we're looking at 8-9 days, and if it's in our organisation, stroke service is less than 7 days because we have a fantastic community stroke service. So we have been doing lots of things differently. One of the challenges we face is it's like taking 3 steps forward and then 2 steps back, because
guess what, demand goes up every year by 3 or 4%. So I think the system is really struggling to keep pace with demand, and I do think our staff are quite incredible. Right across health and social care, they never cease to amaze me, not only at their commitment, their dedication and their professionalism, but actually they keep coming up with new ideas and a willingness to try something different. So we're not perfect, we haven't cracked it all. We can always be more efficient, we can do more things differently. Sometimes it is difficult just to keep pace with the increasing demand. So as Francis says, you don't see solutions around the corner, and that's why it's multifactorial. I do believe that we need to be more efficient. We can be. That tends to be at the margins. I do believe we need to fundamentally change some of the things we do. I think we can get bigger gains there. But also, I'm clear that there will still be a requirement for investment going forward.
Okay, thanks for that. Just a couple of points from myself, and then I'll let Ed from PHA in say a few words. In relation to maybe to Shane in regards to the ambulances, it's a big concern in the community in regards to ambulances being held at the Ulster Hospital for long periods, then are out of use for in our area. That's always mentioned to me, delays because of that reason. And the other point is probably James and Francis in regards to mental health and care in the community. And I agree, you're better placed for care is in the community. But there are breakdowns in service provision. Too many people with mental health issues, they're ending up in the judicial service. There's self-harm and huge rise in suicides, you know, so there is an addictions as well. And I think there was a report done quite recently that huge numbers of people in Highbank and McGabbery with mental health issues. We've more to do. And I think with Johnny's presentation at the start about community planning and preventative health initiatives certainly is the way forward. You know, getting people the best start in life, getting them a decent education, and then getting them a decent job. I think that's the answer to a lot of the problems, getting them a better health, involved in exercise and whatever. And there has been a huge uptick in cycling and running. You just have to look about. The message is getting there. But I just think we need to put more effort into community planning. That's the vehicle and the conduit to do it. But just maybe on just the mental health stuff and maybe Shane on that.
Yeah, I think in terms of Advent Center, in terms we are, as Seamus has said, we are working in partnership. The two hospitals where we have to do most work is actually Ulster and Craigavon, and that's the irony, of course, of being here today. There are other hospitals that have been able to perform a lot higher than that, and they've looked at structural things in terms of the receiving area. So in other words, what kind of receiving area there is. But it's also about the fact that both those hospitals are unbelievably busy. And if they could release our patients quicker, I have no doubt they would. So it's not a problem that's solved at the front door. It's a problem that's solved as a result of complete hospital reform, as both Seamus and Francis said. So we are working at the front door. We're looking at our HALO with the hospital liaison officer, what they can do to make that quicker. We are looking at alternative ways and pathways that we can use, which can have direct access to certain areas within hospitals. There's lots of work going on. And we are absolutely committed that the hospitals, both Dundonald and Craigavon, are two areas that we are focusing most heavily in, because they're the two areas that are struggling most in terms of numerically.
Yeah.
But absolutely, if the beds were empty, we'd transfer our patients in 10 minutes. They're not. It's a hospital issue. It's not a front door issue.
Right. Thanks, Joe.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Mental health, disability issues, and I think probably I was in the not too distant past the director of mental health and disability for the Southern Trust. So, and we did do a lot of modernisation and reform, as Seamus has said. The issue for us is, and it is recognised regionally and indeed nationally, we are compared to the national funding grossly underfunded in Northern Ireland in terms of mental health and disability services. So I believe we have probably done as much as we possibly can in terms of resettlement of our patients in the community and the development of community services, but we do need a lot more investment. Chair, I'm not sure where that's going to come from. We've made that very explicit, and even in the trust we've said there's a lot more that we could do, but we need a lot more money to do it. And with the demography and changes in our population, with that comes a hugely increased level of mental health and disability as well issues. So I have to be honest and say I think in Northern Ireland, just as Seamus has said, we have actually some of the best mental health services in the United Kingdom, in spite of the fact that we haven't got anywhere near the level of funding that the rest of the United Kingdom has, but we still have a way to go.
Thanks, Seamus.
Francis is much more of an expert in mental health than I am, although sometimes I do wonder about my own mental health, but there you go. I just wanted to pick up on one thing, and Shane kind of touched on it. Ulster and Craigavon, really busy hospitals, but they're also the most cost-effective hospitals of all the hospitals in Northern Ireland. So there's a specialty cost index which are produced every year. The average is 100%. If you're above 100%, then you are more you're dearer, as it were. If you're below, you're less expensive. And the Southern and South Eastern Trust are consistently around 93% of the average cost of health care within Northern Ireland. So you could say we're really efficient. I got to the point where I'm clear we're underinvested. And I think we could do better with what we have, but I'm also very clear there is a real investment issue there for both Craigavon and the Ulster.
Okay, thanks very much. Over to Ed, patiently.
Yes, indeed, Chairman, thanks. What I'd like to do is actually just lift some of the threads from Shane and Seamus and Francis's presentation back to what Johnny was saying at the start. And my colleagues from the trusts have described the significant pressures that they're under day and daily in the light of increasing demands, but also have illustrated a lot of the work that they're putting in to modernise, to improve and transform services. But if I look at it in a slightly different way, if we go back to the population and our communities, one of the key things that Johnny was stressing was the issue of health inequalities. And the fact remains that if you're in the lower income categories, if you have the poorest levels of education attainment, if you struggle to have employment on a regular basis throughout your adult years, the fact is that you are likely to have the lowest levels of health and well-being throughout your life. And we can see that if you take two measures of that. In terms of obesity, so obesity tends to be more prevalent in people who have lowest income, poor educational attainment and employment. Why is obesity important? Obesity is linked with the incidence of cancers, coronary heart disease, and diabetes. And I think we all in the room know how fundamental they are in our society. Similarly, if we look at smoking rates, and smoking clearly linked as well to coronary heart disease and some cancers, and equally the level of smoking tends to be linked with the three indicators of income, education, and employment in general. And I suppose not everyone is in that sort of level of need, but there is something for us in the health service about focusing on those who have the greatest health inequalities. And that's not to say that we can't do things. We can do things, but we've got, as a society and a community, to put more emphasis on investing and prioritising the upstream. We've got to do more, and we are doing more in terms of improving awareness and literacy. And that's where I think community planning comes to the fore, because income, education and employment are not things that the health service is well placed to address. You folks in local government or in education and elsewhere are vitally important in that regard. But for us, that's why community planning is very, very important for the future. And for us also, it offers an opportunity to do things differently, to do things better than we have, and to do more of them over the next while. And similarly, we've mentioned in the course of this, the last 2.5 hours, areas, for example, around dementia. In the PHA, we've been running the I'm Still Me campaign. That has more to go. I suppose, sadly, it's with some regret that some of the campaigns that we've been hoping to roll out won't roll out this year because the funding has had to be removed by the department to address other pressures. But nonetheless, we're committed to working with local government in terms of raising awareness, raising it across all of our councils, and doing that in a much better way. So for us, community planning and the working with you in councils will be quite fundamental to actually trying to turn the curve in some of the issues that are actually placing the pressure on hospital services, and where we can make a difference, and we know we can make a difference. So hopefully, Chairman, that sort of helps square the circle and some of the conversation we've had here this evening.
Thanks very much for that. I suppose just to thank everybody for the participation, and tonight I think tonight has been a really productive meeting, a formative meeting, a constructive meeting. And I think Councillor Walker mentioned his contribution. It is about us all working together, and building a better relationship through community planning and ensuring then that we have better health for our whole community. And there were some people thought the process, this process, wouldn't have been a good process, but I'm sure they have saw the outworkings of it, that it is a good process. And if we work at it and everybody gets involved in our workshops, continue to put questions for, evaluate the responses and see how we can do things better together, I think it'll be good for everybody in the long term. So I think thank everybody. I'd like to thank Shane and Geraldine, Francis, Seamus, Drina, I hope I've got that right, Aldrina, Ed, and Jason. I'd just like to thank for your contributions tonight. So I'll bring the meeting to a close. Thanks very much.
Thank you.